But see if this helps at all. I've been thinking of actual occasions as synchronicities, because they're a meaningful coincidence of the entirety of the past, and therefore they have a synchronistic quality to them. And then I've been thinking that all other forms of causation are derived from synchronicity in some way. They're aspects of the synchronistic phenomenon. This is the basic causality. Right? So efficient cause is obviously the relationship between successive actual occasions, each one of which is a synchronicity, and then those relations are conditioned by aim and form and so forth. But the basic causality in the universe, the means by which things come into existence, is synchronistic. And everything else is a derivative from that. That's how I've been thinking of it, right? So that magical creativity is what's at the core.
But aren't synchronicities things connected in time, but not in space?
No. They're often, almost always connected to space as well.
That's right. I thought two things would happen at the same time without a physical causation, so we can't...
Oh yeah, but in the same physical space, usually. The same experience. They happen in the same moment of experience.
Well, it's the same moment.
And so, in a certain sense, the moment of experience constitutes a space, just more or less.
I'm just saying the word synchron means same time.
Yeah, but obviously synchronicities, when we talk about them, always involve simultaneous almost always involve simultaneous co-presence, and therefore involve space in some way.
Well, like in the synchronistic quantum experiment where they fire two bullets.
I don't want to talk about that as synchronicity. That's non-locality, and I'm not at all sure it's the same thing.
Okay.
Very different principle. I have to really think about the relationship between them.
The non-locality is what I'm saying. They're not connected in space, but
yeah, that's non-locality, but it's not synchronicity.
Oh, okay.
What were you saying about creativity? You said that all basic causality somehow stems from synchronicity.
What issues from creativity are actual occasions, which are synchronicities. That's what I'm suggesting.
We were also looking at this chart from chapter 5.
Yeah, uh-huh. With the four causes of that?
Yeah, and I mean, that was kind of a way of trying to get more deeply into this issue of causes and causality and synchronicity and stuff like that.
Yeah, I just had this idea sitting here that it's so exciting working with you. I was thinking maybe in the fall I could set up a sort of an advanced seminar, which I couldn't do officially as a class, but everybody who wanted to could take it as an independent study. And we could work out different aspects of this theory in a lot more detail. Each one of you could have your own thing you're working on. I think you're interested in something like that.
Kind of what we're getting towards at the end, we didn't really get a chance to talk about it, but in a sense, there is no a-causality.
Yeah, I don't really, you see, Jung used the word a-causality in a very confusing way, because he just meant not efficient causality. That's all he meant.
That's what we got to, exactly, because then we pulled out the chart and said right. There's formal cause, there's all these other
exactly.
causes.
Exactly, right, and so so to think of synchronicity as a-causal, I think, is really misleading. It just has to do with the particular word that Jung chose that was sort of unfortunate, may have been good at his historical era, but it's confusing for us. So synchronicity is not a-causal. I would say synchronicity is primordial causation.
I would just say what Jung meant.
What?
Sorry, it's so important. We've not really talked about that in this way. I just think that's so important.
Yeah, it is important. It's very important.
I think what Jung is saying when he's saying it's a-causal, that this happening over here didn't cause this happening over there, something else is the cause.
Well, exactly.
So it's the a-causal of the events.
Well, you're saying the same thing I said. In other words,
right,
it's not efficient
it's just,
causation, but
right,
there is some principle of causation there. It's just not the ordinary one. So we called it a-causal instead of calling it differently causal, which would have been much more helpful. That's all.
Then how is synchronicity different than the word cause? Is synchronicity a type of cause?
Well, the word cause, as we've discussed before, is extremely broad. It has many, many, many uses. And so I'm just proposing that that in ordinary, everyday, scientifically conditioned English, cause tends to mean efficient cause. And I'm just saying we should broaden that word, broaden the meaning of cause to include formal causes, final causes, and to include synchronicity as a mode of causal operation.
And I'm just asking, what makes synchronicity causation?
It makes something happen. It's a principle by means of which, this is creativity, really. I'm just almost renaming creativity as synchronicity. Something like that. I'm saying, Whitehead says that creativity is that by which the many become one. And I would say the many become one as a synchronicity, and the many are increased by one.
The process of bringing the many into the one,
yes,
is a synchronicitous causation.
Yes, concrescence is synchronous causation, synchronistic causation.
Because you can't really speak efficiently of the whole universe coming into one. That's always been a problem. Like,
right.
How does the whole universe cause me to happen in this moment?
Right.
But if you say there's a synchronistic causality, that's concrescence, that's one way to talk about that in a way that doesn't need to have everything bounce up against each other to, like, billiard balls to make me happen.
Very well said.
Yeah,
so perfectly said.
Okay.
Beautiful.
Because that always tripped me. Like, how can, remember someone, I was trying to explain some of this to my girlfriend. She said, I don't understand how the universe can cause me.
Right.
Everything universe, how is it all connected?
Right, because you think about causality as efficient cause.
Yes, exactly. So if you move it into a different type of cause, maybe you don't even have to say it, you don't even have to clarify formal or efficient or
final.
You just call it the type of cause that concrescence is.
Yeah, exactly. Beautiful. Very nice. Misty, really high. Yes.
You said that synchronicity is a meaningful coincidence of...
It's a meaningful coincidence. Well, in the case of an actual occasion, it's a meaningful coincidence of the entire past light cone, at least.
Okay.
Not to mention the non-local effects, which is still hard to quite sort. Okay, so anything else that we'd like to talk about this chapter? I'm kind of excited about the chapter. Anybody have any comments about the chapter?
Lots. But
good.
We'll probably get to them.
Okay, so,
right? So
I thought maybe what I would do then would be to go through some of these summaries I have in here, and then that would give us a chance to bring up all the questions as we go through the summaries. So let's see. But before that, I want to talk about one more thing. Something I wanted to talk about too, guys. We're going to be talking about a lot, obviously, about space and time. And I had shared with you this intellectual crisis that I was going through earlier in the semester, and how I had come through it in part with the realization that the inside and the outside ultimately coincide. Remember we talked about this? And so the idea is that if we look deeply enough into our own subjectivity, we will find the divine ground. And if we look further out into the universal wholeness, we find a divine ground. And the ground we're finding is the same whether we're looking out or whether we're looking in. And so the implication here is that all of actuality rests in the embrace of the divine ground. All the time, right? So that we are each the divine speaking to the divine, all the time. Now, the importance of that is that there are several levels of importance to that. First of all, I consider it to be a fundamental epistemological principle. I'm not sure knowledge is possible unless we posit the ultimate coincidence of the inside and the outside. But we could argue that. But I think that may be the case. Nothing I want to say about that. Also, because of this, let me call it a fact and be bold. Maybe it's not a fact, but let me call it a fact. Because the inside and the outside coexist, therefore, life as a problem has an issue. There's some place to go. Right? Because if it's not possible for us to make a conscious, and we might even say a loving relationship with the divine ground of being, then we are trapped forever or else for one lifetime and no more, but we are irrevocably trapped in ignorance and illusion. Right? We don't really know what's going on. We don't know how to make ourselves exist. And so we are contingent and vulnerable beings, identified with and dependent upon our circumstances at every moment. You with me? Right? But if it is the case that in our secret recesses, inward and upward, in the core of our being, if it is actually the case that we are the being that is manifesting the universes, and if we can focus our attention there, then we can experience the self-existing bliss of the divine, and all attachment to outer circumstances and all fear of outer circumstances falls away, and a hugely powerful compassionate action becomes possible out of that. So, this has been on my mind all week. I couldn't help sharing it. I'm reading Sri Aurobindo's essays on the Gita, and they're just moving me so deeply. And so this issue of the divine and of how it is that our ability to focus our will on the divine opens up a pathway to peace and mastery and powerful compassionate action, it's really exciting. Right? And then I ask the question, like, how much of my life is lived in the spirit of divine sacrifice? Right? Because Sri Aurobindo talks about how all life is built on sacrifice. You know, our being is a gift to others, and others' beings are a gift to us. And all of us are God. All of our actions are divine sacrifices to the divine. And to the extent that we can adopt that attitude, we can begin to move ourselves into identification with the soul, release our egoistic obsessions, and become vastly superior human beings. I'm just very excited about this, right? And it's so close to what we're talking about today, because it has to do with the identity of the inside and the outside. Okay, so that's ultimate. This is sort of this ultimate identity, which, by the way, is timeless. In some way, right? Because the ultimate, the world, you out there, are in my past right now, right? And so we're not exactly simultaneously in that sense, but in some timeless, transcendent sense, the inside and the outside coincide. In manifestation, there's a difference. And now we're getting into the chapter, right? Because in manifestation, by which I mean when we are expressed as finite beings with a position in space, with a position in the creative advance or in time, cut off from each other by abstraction and objectification, like we talked about last time, right? So when we're finite, it sort of seems like there's a world, and the world has all of our bodies in it. And then each one of us is on the interior of one of the bodies that's out there in the world, right? Now, this conception of mind and matter as inside and outside, respectively, underlies all of the thinking in the mental mutation of consciousness. So I really want you to think about this. Like, it seems right now, ordinarily, naively, habitually, that each one of us is first a body, a part of the physical world caused by physical laws, and then secondly, that this body somehow has interiority. Right? And so in some curious way, my body is an expression of my consciousness, and my consciousness is a product of my body. There's some sort of mutual thing, right? And it's simultaneous, right? Because in order to exist in this moment of time, in order to have an inward existence right now, I have to have an outward body, right? Which is the housing for my consciousness. So this is how we usually think of it, right? Okay. In process philosophy, you don't think about it that way. And the distinction between matter and mind, instead of being the spatial distinction of inside and outside, becomes the temporal distinction of past and present. So the body of an actual occasion just is the world out of which it is emerging. And the consciousness is the mental focus for the process of emergence, right? But the body of an actual occasion is its entire light cone. There's no body in the moment. In the moment, there's concrescence. Concrescence leaves behind it what looks like matter, right? And so an actual occasion doesn't have a body, except the universe is its body. And this has huge implications. And in a certain sense, that's what this whole chapter is about, is the implications of this, right? Because to begin with, what it means is that the whole universe exists in me now. The entire past universe is having an existence in me. Now, when you were a sophomore in college, I presume that you played with solipsism. Right? Everybody's supposed to play with solipsism when they're a sophomore in college. It's part of the rules. Right? And then solipsism, of course, is the idea that everything is contained in my experience and there's nothing outside of it. Right? I want to talk about the way in which, the partial way, in which solipsism is true. And the way it is true is that this moment of my existence is a space in which all of you exist right now. I contain the whole past universe. You contain the whole past universe, right? And we're containing each other. So that I am containing you and you are containing me, right? Every actual occasion contains, or in Whitehead's phrase, houses the entirety of its past. And outside of that mutual containment, there is nothing, 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 mere nothingness. There is no space that houses actual occasion. Actual occasions house each other. End of story. Is this a pregnant silence or is this utter bewilderment? Yes, Michael.
In what sense, given what you just mentioned about the trueness of solipsism, mm-hmm. in what sense is personality still an ontological? What does personality become then? If
personality is a sequence of actual occasions. Same thing that it's been all along.
I guess what I'm asking is there an actual distinct difference in the way an occasion houses, like in the way I'm housing the universe as opposed to how you're housing the universe?
Sure, we all have our own different ways of doing it. For example, if you look into Kassirer and his study of symbolic form, or if you look into Getzer and his mutations of consciousness, he's describing the different ways in which we house the universe. And part of the point that's being made, particularly by Getzer, is that the variety of ways in which we can house the past is much, much broader than we might imagine it is. Right? But there are many, vastly different ways of housing the past, and that these mutations of consciousness are some of the big scale changes in that, but each one of us has our own way of doing that. But you see, the reason this is not solipsism is because I'm not saying that each one of us houses a representation of the universe. I'm saying each one of us houses the actual universe.
The same universe.
Yeah. Right? Well, a little bit different. Every one of us is a slightly different universe because we have a different light cone, right? And so each one of us emerges out of an individual universe. And usually they overlap largely, but not entirely. Every universe is somewhat unique. And of course, each one of us remembers the past differently because of our own personal history and lots of differences here, right? It's hugely different. But the point is that science has shown us increasingly that it wants to identify matter, space, time, and energy, right? I want to add consciousness to the list. I want to say that in some meaningful sense, and we always have ambiguity about consciousness, but in some meaningful sense, consciousness and space are the same thing.
Well, if you believe space is made up of actual occasions...
Space is a relationship among actual occasions. Each actual occasion is an atom of space-time. Right? It includes its entire past light cone, something from contemporary occasions non-locally, and all that, right, is in each actual occasion. Really in each actual case. But I was saying to you the other day, Mikey, is that like you are part of my body. Right? You are me. And I am you. Because that's how the universe works. Because I only exist insofar as you perceive me. You and the walls and everything else. Right? And it only exists as long as I perceive it. So existence is an intersubjective communion.
Do you mean like a hologram?
A little bit like a hologram, because each one contains the whole. A little bit like Indra's net. I mean, there's some details to
it. Each one contains the whole, but each one is from a different perspective of the whole. So
that's right.
It has a different phasal relationship to the whole.
Yeah.
And
exactly. You have to bring time in there. But basically, yes, it's a holographic theory in that sense. Very much like the Mahayana Abhidharma in Buddhism, which has a very similar idea. Hawaiian Buddhism and so forth has a very similar idea. So it's not totally implausible. But the remarkable thing about it is that it does away with the terrible alienation and all of the epistemological impossibilities of the modern era. And it does it by making the mind-body distinction into a temporal distinction instead of into a spatial distinction. This is part of the mark of the integral mutation, right? Is that it appreciates the creativity of time instead of being fixated in spatial analysis.
So in speculative realism, when they say that objects are receding, that we can't really know them, in this idea, we can know everything because
that's
everything
right.
is within us.
That's exactly
nothing
right.
is receded, it's
exactly.
all present.
Exactly. I think that idea is weird and actually a little bit evil myself. But that's okay. We can have our disagreements.
Maybe we should punish them for it.
No, it's self-punishing. Anybody who thinks that way is going to be sad. Yeah.
This is a little off topic, but the thing about space and time, I've been thinking about it a lot. And I know that Gebser had a concept called the eruption of time.
Yeah.
Could you just briefly explain what he meant by that?
Yes.
And it, to what extent it might have some relationship to this discussion?
Yes, because throughout the classical period of the mental mutation, all explanation was basically spatial. Right? So things were sorted into categories, which were basically spatial baskets, and analysis was analysis into categories, which were sort of spatial in their basis. Okay. And process wasn't studied very much. Right? The process through which things come to be was assumed to be the same process through which logical conclusions are drawn. And so the world seemed very thought-like, and there was no investigation into the exact details of how things unfold causally in the time. So we have this enormous eruption of time after the Renaissance, when, having discovered the secret of measuring space, people begin using rulers to measure time. Right? They start using clocks to measure time. Right? And then as they begin to measure time, they begin to articulate these laws of how processes unfold temporally. So for example, if things fall at 32 feet per second per second, that's a temporal law, right? And so science, as it moves, becomes more and more about the articulation of these equations, which describe the evolution of systems over time. And science ends up being a series of equations which do nothing but talk about existence happening over time. Then you see it much more coherently manifest in relativity theory, in which the inseparability, not only the inseparability of space and time, but also the priority of time over space begins to emerge. And then, of course, then in quantum theory, the events are short-lived, right? So you get time, again, they're temporal processes instead of substances that are just fixed eternally, like atoms, right? And so in all these ways, and then also in cubism and in Picasso, you begin to see people representing the concretion of time, that is, representing different moments of time simultaneously on the same two-dimensional space, right? So in all these different ways, there's this eruption of awareness of the importance of time. Evolutionary theory is part of the eruption of time. Right? Because when Brian says we are a cosmogenesis instead of a cosmos, he's saying this is a happening, not a place. Right? And that appreciation of the creative force of time is the primary mark of the integral for Gebser. So that's the eruption of time in all these different spheres of... Also, for example, Marxism can be seen as a battle of time against space, where time is labor value, and space is land value, right? So the class distinction actually becomes takes on a certain mutation of consciousness issue.
Didn't he also say, along the lines of the last thing you mentioned, that didn't he kind of say that the French Revolution was kind of like one that really sort of took off, and was that a similar kind of thing of the new society that they were developing not being as stable and land-based or something?
Well, part of what happened there, as Gebser points out, was that the French Revolution came within decades after the invention of the steam engine. Right? And so the steam engine is part of the eruption of time, right? Because it introduces a new form of time into human consciousness, the time of motoricity. Right? And then this time of motoricity creates the left, it creates the laborers, which become the left, right? Which begin to, it's the force of the machine, the force of time embodied as motoricity that begins to disrupt all the spatially oriented social structures that have been in place up until that time.
So the motoricity means that you can do a certain amount of work over a period of time?
That's right, you're paid for your time.
Yeah,
versus
as opposed to owning land. You see, so you're paid for time instead of for space.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, if I have an acre and I can go to grow 30 years of corn or whatever,
right?
That's what I can do in a year, but we don't think about it as a year because it's just like that's when it's going to happen. It's just going to happen when the corn's ready.
Yeah, I mean, there's always time involved. Right,
but it's, we don't think of it as
the same
way.
No, because the power is in having the land. The person who owns the land has the power, right? But then you get people dispossessed from the land who only have their labor to sell. Labor is a time value, and the left becomes a celebration of time value over land value or static value, so it gets caught in a mutational process that way.
Thank you.
Now, let's go find that summary. I know it's in here. Here we go. Okay. On mine, it's on page 209. I don't know what page it is on yours. But it says, let's pause here to review the main points covered so far in this chapter. If you can find
page 22 of chapter 9.
What do you have?
Page 22.
22, okay. So, we began by observing that even in terms of both relativity theory and common sense, the very notion of space is undefined except in situations where movement or causal propagation is restricted to some finite velocity. Also, time is more fundamental than space, that we are calling the complex of time and space, time-space. Okay, so did you follow that part of the argument where I talked about time and space being inseparable and how, in a certain sense, time is more fundamental? Any problem with that?
I don't get that move. if they are inseparable, then how does one become prior to the other?
Because what I'm suggesting is that space can only be defined in the context in which there's a finite upward bound on the velocity of causal transmission. So there can't be space if influences can be communicated infinitely fast. But also, there could be time if there was no movement whatsoever. Right? But there can't be space if there's no time.
Wait, there can be
time without space. Yeah. Because, you know, like going back to, for example, Leibniz, just to give a general idea, he talked about time as being the order of succession and space as being the order of coexistence. So if you have more than one thing existing, you have to have space. But if you don't have anything existing, you can still have time.
But if there's nothing exists, there's no variation from one moment to the next.
Well, maybe you're right. Maybe you can't have time. That's a good point. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
Like motion is the changing of the whatever it is that's changing,
right.
And that's what creates a new thing.
You're actually right. What I said there is not exactly correct. But I still think there's a sense in which time is probably more fundamental. My argument fails on that. You guys are right. Sorry.
Ladies and gentlemen, one of the best professors I've ever had here. You don't hear that very often.
I have to be that we do that. But it's not a critical point. Okay. We explored the nature of experiential time-space and saw that it can be described as a mandala, an array of meaningful events coordinated around a privileged center. Every actual occasion, every job of experience apprehends the world in this mandala form. Now, this to me is so obvious and so desperately ignored in all modern thought. And it's the fact that every moment of experience has a center and a fringe and is intrinsically coherent. Right? It seems to me that all science and all epistemology rests on that simple fact. Right? This is as important as the inside and the outside coinciding, is the fact that each and every actual occasion is a mandala. Right? Which means it can be analyzed, which means that science is possible, which means that language is possible, right? If it weren't for the fact that every moment of experience is intrinsically coherent, no form of analysis would be possible. Right? And so this mandala-like aspect of every appearance, and in process philosophy, I would argue all the way down to the subatomic particles, every entity has its own consciousness at the center of its own mandala. Right? I just think that that's so important, and that really many, many, many modern confusions would disappear if we just acknowledged that fact. And by the way, that's synchronicity, right? There.
One
of the
comprehensions and so forth.
Yeah. We then consider the relationship between mandala time-space and scientific time-space, and concluded that of the two, mandala space-time is more fundamental. Each actual occasion with its mandala of experience houses or contains the entirety of its causal past, and is in turn contained within the occasions that will make up its causal future. Outside of this mutual containment, there is nothing whatsoever. In other words, actual occasions are not contained or housed in some neutral extended nothingness. Rather, they are contained or housed in each other, so that each is a creative unit, or atom, as Whitehead would say, of time-space. Okay? This is really different from the way we usually think. And it's also different from the way, for example, Sri Aurobindo thinks. This is really interesting. Like, you know, he's still part of the mental mutation. He talks about Purusha and Prakriti, as if, in a certain sense, not exactly, but they're sort of mind and matter-like, in that the property is sort of the outside and the consciousness is sort of the inside. And I think that really vitiates the brilliance of his thinking, because he just didn't penetrate into this process mode. Okay, so these considerations led us to a relational theory of time-space. an idea originally suggested by Leibniz and further developed by Whitehead. So this idea of time-space as a relation is an extremely important idea, and I want to spend a little bit of time talking about that. Newton, as we know, and Michael might have some speculations about why this is, really wanted there to be an absolute space-time, just fixed and general and there for things to happen in, right? And Descartes was along the lines with that, and so was Nicholas of Cusa, who made God's first contraction, the contraction into metrical space-time, and so forth, right? So there'd been this tendency, in fact, as I was mentioning to Michael this morning, that this philosopher Thomas More, in the generation before Newton, had come up with this theory that space is God. And he did it by listing all the attributes of God, you know, infinite, eternal, blah, 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 and listing all space and concluding that they must be the same thing because they had the same attributes. And in fact, Newton considered space and time to be God's sensorium. That was really what he believed. Okay, so there's this idea of space out there, but Leibniz does this really interesting thing, which I find very clever. Let's see if you guys find this clever and interesting. And it was in the chapter. Leibniz articulates the principle of the identity of indiscernibles, which fascinates me. Right? Basically says, if you're trying to say there are two things, but there is nothing whatsoever to distinguish them, there's really only one thing. Right? So Leibniz says, picture infinite extended space. He says, now, first of all, it can't just be one point, right? So in order to even think about space, you have to think multiplicity. There's got to be a lot of points. Okay, so space is now an infinite array of points, and it's infinite in all directions, and no point in that space by itself is in any way distinguished from any other point in that space. They're all perfectly identical, all exactly in the center of an infinite expanse. They're all exactly the same thing. And so by the principle of entity, of identity of indiscernibles, an extended space of points is no different from a single point. I like that. Anyway, so what he derives from that is that there can only be space if there are entities in relationship with each other, and the entities have to be differentiable, right? So you have to have differentiable entities in relation in order to have space and time, I guess, right? And so space-time becomes a relationship. In science in the modern world, Whitehead refers to it as the space-time relation. So that space-time becomes not a container, but a pattern of relationship among the actual occasions. Right? So the spatial pattern tells us where we can expect actual occasions to happen, because they always happen somewhere within the current space-time structure. And it can tell us something about distance, because the further away it is, the less causally effective it is, right? But it's a relationship among actual occasions. And so any society of actual occasions will have to be in the context of a time-space relation. Now, why is that? I have some other reasons. Let's go through this in order. I'm getting out of order. That'll make me confused. So I'm saying that, here we go, these considerations led us to a relational theory of time-space, an idea originally suggested by Leibniz and further developed by Whitehead. We saw that we can understand points as abstract representations of actual occasions, and lines as abstract representations of relations among actual occasions. The lines become prehensions. Geometry is, at least in part, a study of relations among points and lines. And as we know, there are many different geometries. Thus, there can be any number of different time spaces in terms of which actuality can function. And this is a very important idea. It has generally been assumed in philosophy, and Whitehead made this assumption as late as science in the modern world, that to be actual means to be in scientific time space.
That's what's actual is what's there in time and space, right? He says there's a dominant continuum. In a very, very interesting article he wrote called Uniformity and Contingency, he talks about dreams. He even talks about a very vivid lucid dream that he had. It's a very interesting article. And he talks about how dream time and dream space is nowhere in physical time and physical space, right? And so there are these other continuum, but there is a dominant continuum, which is the metrical time space of waking life, and what appears in that should be called actual. This is his position in science in the modern world. And then he goes on to say that since there could be many geometries, and since we happen to have a particular geometry with three spatial dimensions and one temporal dimension and so forth, we need a reason for why we have this spatial structure and not some other, and that reason is God. So he calls in God to make that decision for his philosophy. In science in the modern world, in process and reality, he transcends that position in the most amazing way. And he starts to say that it's true that every society has to be involved in its own time-space relation. But otherwise, I can't find the other members of my society. I can't indicate them. I'll talk about that a little later, right? And so if society doesn't share some time-space structure, it can't be a society at all. But that these time-space structures are simply intrinsic to societies, and that as societies change, the time-space structure in which they exist can shift. And so the time-space structure itself becomes an ongoing evolution, right? That isn't fixed once and for all, right? So it's really remarkable the way he does that, breaking out of the strictures of a geometrical time-space into the freedom of time-space as an almost infinitely variable relation, set of relations among actual occasions. You following this?
Well, you're just, like in the dream, the geometry of the dream would be based on the relationships of entities in the dream.
Exactly.
And so instead of trying to predefining the time-space and then trying to see how things fit in the time-space, time-space is derived from the relationships of the entities.
Yes.
So it's totally fluid.
Yes, but there should be rules there. In other words, dream space is very fluid, but not totally fluid. So, for example, in almost all the dreams that I've had, there's been a projective geometry. That is, I have a place in the dream, and all the other entities in the dream are arrayed around me such that I could draw a line to each one of them. So there's a certain projective geometry that seems to characterize many dream experiences, for example, and so forth, right? So my idea is that we move beyond the metrical space-time physics, which only applies to inorganic entities, and we get into this astral space-time. It's not totally fluid. There are rules, but they're less constrained than the rules for the inorganic occasions.
Would it be based on the logic of the forms that are existent in that dimension? In other words, whatever formal relationships are occurring, they have their own inherent coherent logic. And so the way they're related according to that logic is going to determine...
That's very interesting, and I think it's a long way in the right direction. I do think that formal properties of formal resonance, are much, much more causally effective in the astral world than they are in the waking world. But I don't want to give up efficient causes in the astral world also. So I think what you're saying is really important, but I want to say there are efficient causes in the astral, but the formal component of them is much more highly determinative than it is in the physical. Yes?
Wouldn't that, if Whitehead says what's actual is in waking space time?
No, only in science in the modern world. He gives that up.
Right, because otherwise you couldn't have causal efficiency outside.
Exactly. No, I'm saying it's one of those amazing things. You know, like I was just getting this big compliment for giving up my position, but Whitehead did it all the time. He came up with this position in Science of Modern World, and then he saw much deeply. He saw right through it in Process and Reality. So
a question on if you have a chunk of rock that's just moving in space, is there an occasion for every slight discernible position change?
Not only that, there's a multiplicity of occasions, because every atom has a new occasion for every position change.
Okay. Because in some ways,
actual occasions don't move. Movement is always a sequence of actual occasions.
Does that make it discontinuous?
There is an element of discontinuity.
I'm convinced that we cannot describe the actual world without using the idea both of continuity and of discontinuity. They're complementary ideas. You can't do without either one. You know, Whitehead talks about actual occasions as atomic, but he talks about them completely flowing into each other smoothly. Bergson talks about everything flowing smoothly, but there's a rhythm in the process. See, you can't get away from it, right? It's continuous and discontinuous. It's just, you can't get away from that, yeah.
I'm trying to grasp this geometry thing, because it makes sense to me that, okay, you can have actual occasions and draw points and lines between them and get an infinite number of geometries. But then what's happening in the physical world still has to make sense, too.
Yes.
So the geometry we're used to with triangles and parallel lines and all of
that's
this.
That's Euclidean geometry.
How do we get that from starting with the geometry of actual occasions?
Well, because physics is the study of low-grade occasions by high-grade occasions.
So
we look at the physical world. Right? One of the things that scientists have learned to do is to isolate the inorganic from its living context so it can be observed in abstraction. And when we observe inorganic occasions, the fact that they're operating in a metrical geometry becomes obvious.
So what does that mean? They're operating in a metrical geometry, so if you watch some balls hit each other and then you chart, you're saying that the progression of actual occasions goes according to these rules, which are the geometry we call...
Right. You thought that's Euclidean geometry, right?
And the rules are more strict or more limited in the physical world than they are in the transphysical world.
Right, yeah.
Right, so for example, in the physical world, once you get past a certain size and about the size of an atom, movement becomes continuous and not discontinuous. There aren't big jumps, at least usually. But also, more importantly, you're always moving according to the rules. All inorganic occasions move according to geometrical rules. Right? And the discovery, you see, the space-time structure that is conditioning a society is an eternal object. Right? Okay? A relation, it's a logical structure, and therefore it's an eternal object. So, if I look at a society of occasions, let's say, for example, I look at the society of occasions constituting my past light cone in the waking world, I can discern the eternal object that orders its interactions. I can see the space-time that's there. Right? And science has taught us to focus in on the space-time of the inorganic occasions in which we're embodied, and to think that's the only real space-time. But in fact, our consciousness lives in a different space-time than the physical. Making sense?
Mm-hmm. So it just struck me, based on what Caleb said a minute ago, part of the problem people have with incapable of breaking out of the scientific mentality is that they're used to the level of exactitude that's only possible in a world that is so constrained. And so in the transphysical worlds, because things are less constrained, we can't understand them in the same exact kind of way. And that's an ideological problem for somebody who's been trained that if you really want to understand something, you have to really know it measurably, exactly, whatever, you know?
Exactly.
Well, I was
brilliantly said.
On the other end, I've just been living this lately so much. I've been so into this that I couldn't think anymore how it would happen in the physical world. I couldn't get anymore. How could you have
is
geometry?
The physical world so constrained?
Yeah.
Even in the physical world.
I feel really weird right now. Like,
Good
My
for
brain's
you.
Not even working.
Good for you.
Well, the relational meaning is different in the transphysical world. So the meaning of our relationship is this time-space relationship, but in the transphysical world, the meanings, the relational meanings can be like importance or like familiarity or
That's
love
right.
or
That's right.
different values.
That's
and so the geometry in those spaces can actually be defined by desire and passions and different
That's
types
right.
of things.
That's you got it. Exactly, right? So I would suggest something like this. This is really loose and just so tentative. It's just like a suggestion for some place to begin thinking. That in the astral world, there is a dominant presence of a projective geometry in which there are no parallel lines, right? But there are things arranged in scenes. And distance is defined exactly as you're saying it. Distance is a qualitative relationship, not a quantitative relationship, right? Now, how to work the logic of qualitative distance is the secret to the science of the astral. I don't know the answer. Right, but that's what all the old magicians were working on with their different and archetypal and so forth. Right, they're all trying to work on this issue in some way, but I'm giving it a particular focus
because they want to bring it back into the physical. That's the problem.
Well, that's part of the problem. Part of it is they actually are trying to get oriented in astral space. I mean, a lot of the old Kabbalistic meditations and everything, they'd say you leave and you go here and you go there and you get this question and that question. You know, there's some attempt to map out and articulate the structure of these transphysical spaces. How successful it's been in the past, I don't know. Exactly what methods we should be using, I don't know. But the principle is, and you just got it really beautifully, it's between you and me, that there is a geometry, but it's much less constrained. And distance is defined in some qualitative way rather than any kind of quantitative way. That's as far as I know. But I think there's a lot more that can be worked out starting on that basis.
Well, can we ask what the true difference between quality and quantity is? It seems like at the heart of this is an insistence that they have to be different. And I think that problem that you refer to is this...
You don't see any difference between quantity and quality?
I didn't say that. I don't see any difference. I don't know if they're truly different.
Well, how would they be?
I think
be
they're two different ways of looking at the same thing.
So, what does that mean? That's interesting. When you say quantity and quality are two different ways of looking at the same thing, what do you mean?
Well, I could describe red as a quality, but the physicist would describe it as a set, as a frequency, as a range.
Right. See, I... What the physicists do is absolutely unconvincing to me. And here's why. I mean, I agree that their instruments show the number 440 under certain circumstances when red light hits them at a certain angle. I'm not arguing with that, right? But what I'm saying is that whatever the frequency is, any number, 3,672, is not red.
It's not, but red is also, it is empty without, I think they
This is the scientific point of view. This is the scientific point of view that you're articulating, right? That quantity and quality are necessarily together. I mean, so for example, when I was younger, I was in high school, I wasn't that great at science when I was in high school. And here's the kind of problem I would have. People said to me, force equals mass times acceleration. I said, oh, okay, I get that. I said, but what's force? They said, it's mass times acceleration. I said, well, what's acceleration? They said, it's mass divided by force, right? And that's as far as they would go, because they acted as if the universe consists of quantities. But of course it doesn't, because the fact that these are three different variables means that there are three different qualities, each one of which has its own measurement procedure for being converted to a number. Right? But force and mass and acceleration are qualitatively different. Now, there is a procedure by which these qualitative differentiations can be represented numerically. And this numerical relationship does obtain. But that doesn't mean that these are mere numbers. They're not.
That's not what I'm suggesting. I think that the other way is also the wrong direction, I think, to make everything just quality.
I didn't do that either. I wouldn't do that either. Whitehead says there are two different types of eternal objects. Mathematical eternal objects and the rest. And the difference is this.
that mathematical relations are descriptions of external relations. That all mathematical relations are external relations between independent entities.
That's
why I'm saying geometry is still applicable to transphysical worlds, because there are still separate entities causally interacting. Right? But at the level of the soul, in which all things are one, there's no mathematics operating. Right? Mathematics is a description of the way we're separate from each other.
But there is quality at the level of the soul.
Absolutely.
It seems to me like both would disappear at the level of the soul, not just either or.
I don't think so. You see, I think, and again, these are very subtle issues, and we're being very speculative, and so I really want to honor that. But I would just suggest this logic, that there's a difference between the upper hemisphere of being, which is not manifested, and the lower hemisphere, which is manifested. And the manifestation involves the deployment of separated individuals. And whenever there's a deployment of separated individuals, there has to be a space-time structure that also unites them. And mathematics is involved in describing that, and all the attenuation of qualities across time and space. But it's, although it's implicit, both quality and quantity are implicit in the divine. They're not expressed in the same way. And that it's not clear to me at this moment what the operation of mathematics would be in the upper hemisphere, but given a few minutes, I think I could come up with a lot of them. So I think I'm going to agree with you, actually, in the end of all that.
When you put force equals mass times acceleration, that is a geometry, right? Because that is a set of relationships that act in a particular way.
It's not actually geometry, it's arithmetic.
I'm sorry, it sets up a type of space, because you're defining you're defining a relationship, so now the relationships.
In the background, there's the assumption of space, because this assumes multiple objects and therefore assumes space.
But okay, I'm thinking even in the transphysical, like that's a type of space in the transphysical. Those qualities being related to each other in a particular logical way.
I want to make a distinction. Valid question, but I want to make a distinction between logical relations and spatial relations.
Okay.
They're not the same kind of thing. They're a ontologically different kind of thing. Right? Abstract relations like F equals MA are timeless, eternal objects.
Okay, so there is time and space in the transphysical.
That's right.
And that's separate from timeless forms.
That's right. Yes.
Okay.
Beautiful.
So I got that.
That's beautiful. That's great. Okay.
If there's time, space in the transphysical, and you said before you don't want to negate the idea of efficient cause in the transphysical.
Yeah.
If there's efficient cause in the transphysical, what is the relation between the physical of the transphysical and the physical of the non-transphysical?
Well, the difference is this. It would be better to use the word material than physical. But when I say physical in this context, I'm using Whitehead's terminology. It's a little bit sloppy. But what I mean is actual. By physical, in this case, I mean actual. I use it in two different ways. When I'm being sloppy, I use the word physical or efficient cause to mean actual, between actual occasions. When I'm being more precise, I'll use physical to refer only to inorganic occasions, low-grade occasions.
Physical meaning only low-grade occasions.
Yeah, so in other words, sometimes, my language is a little sloppy, sometimes I want to talk about the mental world, right, which is a world of high-grade actual occasions in a very complex space-time, right? And then we have the astral, which is a world of medium-grade actual occasions. And then we have physical, which is low-grade actual occasions. And low-grade actual occasions in our cosmic epoch operate in a metrical time space. Right? So these are actual occasions. This is a world of actual occasions of low-grade, a world of actual actual occasions of medium grade, the world of actual occasions of high grade, right? And in a certain sense, there's three different types of matter: physical matter, astral matter, and mental matter. Right? You can think of it that way, although all matter is inhabited by consciousness called actual occasions, right? But in effect, the physical world is made up of physical actual occasions, the astral world is made up of medium-grade actual occasions, high-grade actual occasions. So these are all material in the sense that they're individual, that they are the subject of causes and the generator of causes. Right?
Okay, so what would be the material connection between, if there is one, between the astral, transphysical world and the physical slash mental material world?
The one I started, you said the last thing before.
Well, you don't have mental without physical, right? I mean, they're going to be...
Well, okay, you see, the point is that we're having a linguistic confusion here that I'm really sorry about. I'm going to try to clarify. When I use mental, in this case, I don't mean the same way I do when I'm talking about the mental pole of an actual occasion. It's a different use of the term. I should probably change these words around. I'm not sure how to do it yet. Every actual occasion has a mental pole, and when I'm being consistent, I will say it has a causal pole. Whitehead calls the causal pole the physical pole, which is confusing because I want to restrict the word physical to the inorganic. You following me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the way these interact is what I've been talking about through the whole book, right? It's that the aims of these occasions come down and organize the behavior of these occasions to make atoms and molecules and cells and so forth, right? So that the presence of the transphysical in the physical is an ordering principle.
I guess, okay, maybe just ask a more basic question. If I'm experiencing a transphysical reality, I guess the thing that got me before is when you talked about the inefficient presence in the transphysical reality, because it makes me feel like, okay, well, if I can be efficient in a transphysical reality, how does that efficiency relate to my waking world?
Well,
for example, if I'm like in my transphysical world and I'm in the gym and I'm working out,
right,
and in my waking world is my body gotten
right,
more fit?
Right. So let's say, I don't know if you've had this experience, but have you ever had the experience of trying to speak in front of a hostile audience?
Sure.
And you find yourself just shriveling, right? And then other people will look at you and support you, and then you'll feel yourself swelling up, right? That's astral efficacy, right? So like in waking life, if I open up my heart and love you, you'll feel better. That's efficient causation in the astral, going through the astral world, right? Mm.
It's not my loving you affects your body. My loving you affects your
astral
soul,
body.
And then your soul affects your body.
No, let's be a little more precise. You're loving me on the astral. Now, you could be loving me in a soul way and affecting my soul. But you could be loving me in an emotional way and affecting my heart, my astral body.
Okay.
Right? So
but
I...
But it affects your physical
body.
It
does.
Because you start to change your whole
absolutely
body.
Absolutely.
But it's not happening from body to body. It's happening...
Look, let me just draw this. This is actually the next chapter, but briefly.
Well, what if you love someone just for their body?
Yeah, but which body? The astral body?
No, the physical. What if you love someone
the
just for
is,
the physical
the personality
body?
It's a low-grade love.
That's a good song.
The personality consists of a mental body, an astral body, and a physical body, right? And we know that this astral body consists of all these different occasions of the cells and the tissues and so forth, and that this mental body consists of all the minds of the higher organs and the sense organs and all these other minds that make us up, right? So we got this whole thing going on here. We usually think that this is person A, and this is his girlfriend, person B. I love A and B, they're my favorite people. Okay, so the usual thought is that if I have a thought, I send it down to my astral body, which goes down to my physical body, which activates my vocal cords, sends a signal across here, and then it gets translated back up. Right? So this is the way we usually think of messages, right? But what I'm suggesting is that actually there's direct empathic communication going on among many of these and among many of these.
And they cross over, like,
my mental to your physical. I don't know how that
sure. works. No, no problem, right? So, like, you know, if I try this sometime, you're working out, you're having a really bad day, and get somebody to really love you, and you'll find out you can lift more. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, I didn't have an exact experience, but I did have a similar experience. I was having a really bad day at the gym with a friend, and I just could barely press anything. And then we got involved in talking about philosophy, and I could suddenly press 30 more pounds without any effort. Right? So, you know, so clearly there are these influences going on, like very complex patterns of influence. And so, you know, we need to rethink psychotherapy on this basis. We need to rethink sociology and history, right? All those disciplines have to be rethought on the basis of this more complex understanding of the nature of our causal interactions through the transphysical worlds.
Yeah, so again, so the efficient causation in the transphysical world, if I have I have a different kind of access to different kinds of information and maybe a different kind of bodily awareness in the transphysical world.
That's right.
So if I'm ill in my physical world, how could I use what I'm able to do in a transphysical world to affect my physical body in the way?
Beautiful, beautiful. Now, that's a great question, because that is the question. That's the foundation of the new health technology that comes with this new paradigm, right? Because remember that the shape of my body is the influence of transphysical entities on the physical molecules, right? And so everything in my body is permeated by transphysical influences. Most disease, according to the people who studied this, begins in the transphysical planes and works itself out down into the physical, right? And so if we were able to lucid dream or to operate freely out of our bodies, a lot of people have claimed that when you look at a physical body from the astral world, you can see it all the way through inside and out with no obstruction. So think about your diagnostic skills. But not only that, right? If you could actually learn to focus the creative potency of the transphysical occasions to shift the body, I think you'd be able to achieve levels of healing which no inorganic medicine-based could ever get you, right? I mean, you can maybe even regrow limbs. Who knows, right? I mean, the possibilities of working with the body, or since the body is about 99% transphysical, that's where the medical work should be done, right?
So what do you mean when you say efficient causation in the transphysical world?
All I mean, efficient causation is just the way in which my decisions have impact on others. Period. Right? So if I'm in a dream and I'm talking to somebody, I'm having an exchange of efficient causes with them.
Fully within the transphysical world, though.
Yeah.
It doesn't come down.
No, because the actual occasions of the transphysical worlds are also causally interacting with each other directly. Mm. Right? So what science tries to do is it tries to tell us that everything can be explained by understanding this box. That all the causal forces happening in the universe are happening at the level of the inorganic physical world. And I'm saying, no, there's lots of causal interactions taking place between our astral bodies and between our mental bodies and all these different ways. Huge, complex communication going on between us all the time. And also in the astral world, most of the denizens of which have ever even heard of the Earth, they have causal interactions with each other and stuff, right? So it's a world out there. That's the point.
Yeah. Not just quick technical. When you use the word metrical,
yes,
for Einstein's space.
I'm sorry, but it's not metrical. Einstein's space is not metrical. I'm sorry if I said that.
There's all kinds of metrics.
Right.
You don't have to have, and there isn't only one metrical.
So well, what I mean by metrical is basic. I mean a space in which parallel lines are defined and in which the curvature is constant.
Okay. So that doesn't cover Einstein.
No, it doesn't cover Einstein because Einstein makes space curve unevenly. And Whitehead pointed out that once you have space bending unevenly
cosmology becomes impossible because measurement is undefined over long distances. And that's why he reworked Einstein's relativity theory, to keep space flat and to turn gravitation back into a force.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if you wanted to move on with the point.
Yeah,
so we can still...
whatever. I'd like to do that, or if you have a question, let's do that.
Well, it's a dream question, because... So things in your dreams are actual.
Yes.
But are they always actual? Like, if you dream that you're meeting a person and doing something with them, did that actually happen in all cases, or are there also dreams or mental processes that can happen that aren't actual in that world?
This is a really excellent question. One of the most difficult questions to answer. It's difficult particularly because in the astral world, of all the three worlds, communication is the least reliable. Because in the astral world, you are communicating through a medium like you do in the physical world, but the medium changes everything because all the entities there are always interpreting things in different ways. Or put it another way, because all the occasions in the astral world are medium grade, their interpretations of the world around them are much more complex than are the interpretations of low grade occasions. So they introduce more imagination into their perception. And so it could be that two people in the astral world could be next to each other, but see each other totally differently. Right, it's like I could see you as a dragon, and you could see me as a sweet pea, but somebody else looking at us might see us in different forms, right? And so it's really hard to figure out how to navigate in that space. And so first of all, it's really hard to know how to define objectivity. It's very tricky in the astral world. Probably, in order to define objectivity in the astral world, you have to become extremely dispassionate. Otherwise, you probably just can't do it at all. But then, so there's that whole level of question. But then there's a secondary question, because it does seem like some of our dreams are very private and inward. Some of our dreams really seem like we're out there in the astral world, and some of them don't, right? And so I have this idea, and again, this is a mere hypothesis for investigation, that when we fall asleep, what tends to happen is that the various intelligences of our body, because they're not being so efficiently coordinated by our high-grade mental occasions, they sort of go mythic, and they start sort of communicating with each other, and they're communicating memories and images and interpretations, right? And so it's a real astral experience, but it's sort of a very introverted one among the lower-grade members of my own body. Because then but then if I lucid dream, I bring my mental body back in, it reorganizes my astral body, and then I can attend outward in a conscious way on the astral world. But that most dreaming is just this kind of introverted communication among the different intelligences of the body. A theory, of course, investigated. But your question is an excellent question.
So that brings a question to me. Then what are things like in the mental world? I mean, is the mental world, you mentioned lucid dreaming, is the mental world mostly concerned with the waking world?
No. The mental world is its own world.
Yeah.
And if you really want to get an amazing sense of the mental world and what it's like, you look at book 2 of Savitri, where he goes through all the transphysical worlds. There's nothing like it. And when he starts talking about the mental world, it would just blow your socks off. And he's describing...
Savitri?
Savitri. You know that book? Savitri is Sri Aurobindo's epic poem.
Oh.
Probably the longest epic poem in the English language. Certainly the most beautiful thing I've ever read. And book 2 of Savitri is his journey through all the transphysical world. It's the locus classicus, I think, of information about those worlds in modern English.
But what I'm trying to understand is sort of a simple way of looking at the mental world that is analogous to the way we can look at the astral world as kind of like a dream world.
Well, the point is, our everyday experience of the mental world is deep sleep. The reason is because the difference between that consciousness and ours is so great that we can't really represent it in waking consciousness. That's right. It's not really representable in waking consciousness.
It's so much at a quote-unquote higher level.
Yeah, it's a world of total luminosity. It's a world of very high-grade actual occasions. At one point, Sri Aurobindo describes this endless frieze or sort of line of these like statues, right? And each one of them is infinitely complex and contains the logic of a whole universe. And this is just one of the levels of the mental plane. It's just incredible what he describes, right? And it's just so far beyond what we can represent in ordinary language. I'm not even going to try, but I will refer.
What I'm trying to get to now then is when we're having this conversation, there's something happening outside of just what's going on physically.
That's right.
And there's a high-grade occasion that's directing this from both our standpoints.
That's right. And
is that in the mental world?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so we're kind of operating in the mental
world,
but
right.
Only like in a small fraction of it?
Well, the problem is that we operate from the mental world. And so it's a mental lucidity that animates our waking consciousness. But we're not able to remember what it's like to extrovert our attention on the mental level like we can on the physical. And we just don't have the way, our language can't really represent it very well. And so we can't remember it or speak about it very well.
So it's sort of like there's this concept we've talked about earlier, it's looking through perception as opposed to looking at perception.
Right.
So we can kind of look through the mental world to some extent, but we can't really look at it?
Something like that, although the distinction's a little bit different. When we're awake, our mental attention is completely occupied with the objectifications from the body. Just like our astral body is also. Then when we fall asleep, we begin to be able to have the possibility of extroverting on the astral, although even that doesn't always happen, as you were pointing out. And then again, we could fall asleep on the astral and go to the mental, which is what happens in deep sleep. And there's also a possibility of looking outward, but we don't know how to do it. And if we do it, which we probably do, we have no idea how to remember it in our waking lives.
Okay.
Yes, Bill?
I'm trying to get a picture of the dynamic activity of eternal objects, which you've talked about. High-grade occasions or super high-grade occasions can create new eternal objects?
No, never.
Okay.
No new eternal objects are ever created.
Okay, so I thought you said that one more time. But anyway, okay, right, that makes sense. Possibility space is what it is. But occasions, way high-grade occasions order eternal ideas,
yeah.
Which affects what can be ingressed. Or
No. All that ordering is done for Whitehead by God. The difference is this. The higher the grade of an occasion, the more complex and rich are the eternal objects that it can work with.
Right. But the way you're talking right now, all the action is from on occasion, just picking things out of the eternal object set. And but I thought a moment ago you spoke of eternal objects having an impact on.
Well, yes, eternal objects.
Choices.
Every actual occasion receives from the past all of the eternal objects that were ingressed in the past, and it receives from God some vision of possibilities, some of which may never have been realized before, and it works with those.
Right, so eternal objects equals possibilities always.
And they come from both the past and directly from some divine possibility space.
Right, and do they affect occasion probabilities in any way?
Absolutely, because every possibility structure is an eternal object.
right? And so the probability matrix for any collapse is an eternal object, and they affect each other, obviously. Right? In other words, every actual occasion when it objectifies with certain eternal objects that are belong to it, and did belong to it, and a certain intensity of energy, a certain intensity of experience. Right? So the way in which an actual occasion has efficient causal effects going into the future depend on the intensity of its experience and the particular quality of the complexity, the number of eternal objects that characterize its final satisfaction. So energy is always both qualitative and quantitative in that way.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, how are we doing here? Started at 11:45. It's almost 1:10. That means time for a break? Yeah, let's take a break and let's come back at 25 after.
Okay. So, the primary ordering among occasions in a post-relativistic framework is their causal ordering. That is, we order our past primarily in terms of which occasion was in the causal past of each other occasion. We saw that this ordering can be understood in terms of containment, efficient cause, or memory. So let me open that up a little bit. We used to think that we could order actual occasions merely in terms of their position in absolute space. This was Newton's idea. Relativity forced us to abandon that because we discovered there was no absolute space, and that distance is not only a function of position, but it's also a function of velocity. So depending on which direction you're moving in and how fast, your distance to other objects changes. Make sense? Right? So you can't exactly say in any absolute sense how far apart things are. However, there is one property that is held constant in relativity theory, and that is causal order, right? So if occasion A causes occasion B, in other words, if B causally prehends A, right? Now, this means several things. If B causally prehends A, in terms of our understanding of consciousness as space, then we can say that by prehending B, A, B extends over or includes A in itself. So to prehend and to include become the same thing. Right? Also, this is an efficient cause, clearly, but also it's a memory because it's a re-experience of a past experience. And so this function of prehension includes containment, efficient cause, and memory, all within the notion of prehension. Those are all abstracted out of this basic notion of prehension as the primitive relation between actual occasions. Now, in relativity theory, once B has prehended A, every occasion in the future, no matter how far apart it may think it is from A and B, will still recognize that A caused B. That's invariant in relativity theory. Now, there are these weird exceptions in relativity theory where if this occasion out here and this occasion out here are so far apart from each other that there could have been no causal interaction between them whatsoever, then B might see this one as first and this one as second, or this one as first or this one as second, depending on its own velocity. But that only applies to occasions that have not causally affected each other. Right? So it's a pretty rare thing. But in general, causal order is held constant in relativity theory. And so that becomes the primary way of ordering the past in terms of which occasions have contained or causally influenced the other occasions. Now, the way in which we order the past serves as a scheme of indication. Now, this is a word that Whitehead uses exactly once in Process and Reality, but it had a huge impact on me, and it's become a pretty strong part of my thinking. A scheme of indication is something which enables us to designate particulars, right? So I have to say, Caleb, over there, right? Now, over there is a way of designating Caleb, and I point to him, right? And you are all in a relationship to both of us such that my pointing is meaningful to you. Because I'm in a certain scheme of relations with Caleb that I'm also in with the rest of you. And so we can use that scheme of indication to indicate each other, to say which one. Right? Actual occasions cannot function in the absence of a scheme of indication. So, for example, consider the situation in which some of the cells in my retina are objectifying themselves as lines, right? Border lines, right? Now, somewhere later in the stream of occasions making up my body, those little lines have to be reassembled into a picture of something, right? There's got to be some way to put them back together. This is called part of the binding problem. How do all the individual perceptions from the various sensory neurons get combined into a complex picture? Now, suppose that your cell, let's say your retinal cells, just detach these abstract objects like lines or areas or colors or whatever, right? And just fed them into the nervous system without any other information, it would be impossible to reassemble them into a picture, right? There's got to be some indication which says that this line came from here. So at the later occasions can say, oh, if this line came from here and that line came from nearby, I could put them together, right? And so obviously, as each individual sensory cell takes in its information, it takes in the whole world because it's an actual occasion, right? But because of my influence on its aim, it objectifies itself to me as the whole world with one line highlighted. And then this cell over here presents me the whole world with one color highlighted, right? And then later on, a higher grade occasion can say, oh, look, we got this line and this color, they came from the same place because they are both objectifying the whole world, and so they can be then reassembled into a picture, right? But in order for that to happen, the different prehensions have to have some scheme of indication in which they can agree that certain perceptions came from the same object. They have to be able to designate which one, right? Now, the way we do that primarily is space-time. Space-time is our primary scheme of indication. It lets us say where and when things are, which is how we indicate their individuality. There are other schemes of indication that are more subtle, the language and so forth, but let's stick with this, right? That every society has a scheme of indication, and that its scheme of indication in general will be the time-space relation under which it's operating. With me on that?
Okay. I'm thinking about like in computers, they have a format. So when they take the information in, it's in a particular format, so it knows the first bit is the first dot.
That's a very interesting analogy. It's a kind of Kantian analogy, right? Because Kant sort of gives us this picture where there's a world out there, and then there's an ordering scheme in here, and so as a thing coming from the outside, they get plugged into the ordering scheme. It's like you're saying with the computer, right? But Whitehead's a little more subtle because he says the order is actually out there, and that we prehend the order, and by prehending the order, we can actually learn the system in which we're going to assemble our data, right? So Whitehead breaks that inside-outside thing that Kant gets trapped in. And the computer metaphor gets too Kantian for my comfort. Okay, and then we saw that the geometries, in terms of which we order the past, and of course anticipate the future, can be more or less constraining as they involve greater or fewer definitions and axioms. Thus, as we will see, there's a hierarchy of geometries moving from metrical geometries at one end to non-extensive networks at the other.
Is it non-extensive?
It, you know, if it says extensive, then it's an error, because I have it changed here. Wherever it says extensive networks in this chapter, it should say non-extensive networks.
Oh, that was a big question.
Yeah, I hope I fixed that in the latest edition, but that was an error in my thinking, actually, earlier on. But always, when it talks about networks, they should be non-extensive networks.
That makes much more sense. But I actually had a question before we move on to geometries on that the system of indication.
Yeah.
You had one more bullet point in that section, and I found it really confusing. I didn't understand
which
what you're
one?
Saying. The time-space relation conditions the transmission of causal efficacy. Fine. But then the sentence describing that, much of our science is concerned with the idea of attenuation of causal efficacy with increase in distance, like gravitational fields. And distance is always a relation defined by time-space relation. So I didn't know if you were saying that that was still part of what science is concerned with or what it should be.
I noticed that in my copy it's not there.
Okay.
So I probably got it so confusing that I eliminated it.
That whole bullet point.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's just cross it off. That's what I did.
So I had a question that kind of relates to what we've been talking about these last three bullet points, and then also the diagram of towards the beginning of the chapter, where there's the
parabolas.
Yeah, the parabolas. And so I can see how this works on the level. Yeah, let's just find it. Okay. All right. Page 9. There's
the figure 1 or figure 2?
Oh, I think figure 1.
Okay.
I mean, either one, but
okay.
Yeah, actually, figure 2 is bigger. It's on page 14. So, this is true of actual occasions, but this is kind of probably a little off topic, but I'm this discussion about causal ordering and schemes of indication brought to mind. So Gebser came up with a schema of the archaic, magical, mm-hmm. mythic, and mental. And Ken Wilber took that schema and created his own, and he said that in opposition to the way that Gebser looked at it, he said that the mutations of consciousness that succeeded to other ones in time transcend and include the ones that were prior. Now that language sounds a lot like this diagram, and it sort of goes along with this thing of causal ordering and in particular.
So it really doesn't have anything to do.
So these are on completely different levels.
Completely different conceptual areas. The analogy is not suggested.
Well, I wouldn't make the analogy, but I wanted your comment on it. And that comment that you gave me is all I need. Thank you.
Okay. And so now this whole business in the last point I just read about the different numbers of axioms and so forth, does that kind of make you guys read that through and make sense of it? How the different geometries have more or less propositions in them and so forth, they're more or less constrained. Do all that make sense? Projective geometry, all that stuff. Okay. I found out in the last few weeks that the logic I used here for those different geometries is actually a little bit out of date. This is logic that I got from Russell, who was writing in the early part of the 20th century. But later in the 20th century, I now know, they developed something called the theory of groups. And the theory of groups, I'm sure, is a much better way to do the mathematics of this section. But I would have to learn it and rewrite it, and I'm not going to do that right now. But I just want you to know that if you want to get involved further in the analysis of the geometry of the transphysical worlds, look for the theory of groups, which is quite fascinating in its own right, and which would have enabled me to write this chapter in a more elegant and complete way if I had known it.
Can you suggest a little more detail about what that might look like to groups contributing?
The theory of groups recognizes that mathematics is more about operations than about the entities that they're operating on. And so a group is a set of operators on a domain which have certain characteristics. So, for example, arithmetic is a group which applies to the domain of numbers. And the reason is because any sequence of arithmetical operations on numbers always yields other numbers. And no matter how long your sequence of operations is between one number and another, you can always get back to the first number by one operation of either addition or subtraction, right? And so if you have a set of operators over a domain, which is such that all the actions of those operators have a result that remains within the domain, and so that you can get back to your first starting point by one operation, that operation is called a group. And so there turn out to be certain groups of geometrical operators which apply within certain ranges of constraint. So for example, there are certain, like for example, in Euclidean geometry, the size of the object is irrelevant, only its relative, right? So it's invariant over size, it's invariant over rotation and so forth, and there are six or seven different things that are invariant in Euclidean geometry, but then there are geometries in which fewer and fewer of those things are held to be significant. And so, for example, there's a geometry in which all closed figures whatsoever are all considered equivalent because changes in angles and sides don't count, stuff like that. So it's a whole different way of thinking about geometrical relations, which is just extremely elegant and allows us to line up all the different types of geometry, some of which I didn't even know about until last week, line them up extremely elegantly in a mathematical way. And it would have helped this chapter if I had known that, but it would have made it less comprehensible, so I'm not entirely sorry that I did it this way.
That would give you some better way to get at the character of dream space?
It might.
For example?
It might. But it certainly would allow me to make these points about different geometry, the different constraints, right, in a much more elegant way.
But Whitehead does this, right? Isn't this all his stuff? And doesn't he name specific geometries? And, or is this your thing?
He doesn't do that, really. He's not really, you see, Whitehead is not interested in transphysical worlds. He never really quite got there. And so he's more interested in how measurement is possible than he is in how other worlds with different geometries could be possible. He just never took his thinking very far in that direction.
Although he knew enough to, if you wanted.
He did know, and if you read that one interesting essay, Uniformity and Contingency, you can see him right on the edge. He also definitely believed in telepathy, you know. So he was close, but you know, different time.
Too big a jump.
All right. So then we have another summary section, which is several pages later. Right toward the end of the chapter, it says summary. Anybody got that? 1, 2, 3, 4 pages back from the end of the chapter.
32.
What?
It's page 32.
32, summary. Okay. We saw that in an ontology of actual occasions, each actuality contains or houses the entirety of its causal past. Each occasion, after completing its own concrescence, is then contained in future occasions. Thus, every actual occasion is an atom of space-time. No neutral time-space exists in its own right as a container for the process of actualization. Beyond actual occasions, there is mere nothingness. We saw that as systematic relationships exist among actual occasions in any given society, where we consider even our evolving universe as a society of actual occasions. This relationship is the geometry of the time-space in that society, and it functions to establish a causal order among the relevant occasions, enabling them to be sorted into the immediate past and the more distant regions of the past. Provide a scheme of indication, enabling the various occasions in that society to refer to other particular occasions. This allows us to indicate, to point out specific actualities in the environment. Also, because the various occasions involved in perception can indicate to one another that they refer to the same external actualities, it allows those occasions to bind their experiences together into a unified whole, as in the synthesis of data from various rods and cones in the eyes into a single picture, or in the synthesis of various sensory modalities into a single presented image of the surrounding world. Provides each new occasion a position within its region of the creative advance, determining the perspective of that occasion on its world, and governs the attenuation of causal efficacy with distance, as for example in the inverse square law governing gravitational attraction, Newtonian mechanics, which specifies the force of gravity as a function of distance. Yes?
That was the point that we struck out before.
Right, exactly.
So,
is it clearer here?
Governs the attenuation of causal... Yes. I'm trying to understand what it means exactly.
Well, what I mean...
So do you think that... Oh, right, okay.
Well, what does it mean?
Well, you said before that if another occasion is closer to you, it's going to have a larger effect on you. But that's not necessarily true always, depending
no.
on what...
I said like as a general rule.
More physical than higher.
Well, I think even in the higher, the closer it is to you, the more effect it'll have, but distance is defined totally differently, and so...
Okay,
but the main point is that space in general is a very primary factor governing the intensity of causal objectification. In general, and there are other reasons that will go against this, but in general, the further away a thing is, the less concrete its impact on me will be, the more abstractly I will apprehend it.
And is that just a limitation that we have, or is it necessarily so? Because you've got like clairvoyance that can equally analyze someone right next to them as someone on the other side of the world.
Right, and that's because in astral and mental space, those things are next to each other.
Oh, okay. So when you say distance, it's the distances, the different distances in the different spaces.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah, we're very stuck with the words, what we think they mean.
Yeah, perfect, Linda. That's great.
Eric, can I ask you a question?
Yes, please.
Can you talk to me about nothingness? Because I guess it just goes so against my entire thought process. But
what does? Exactly.
The idea of nothingness.
Well, I'm not presenting an idea of nothingness.
Well, what it says here, beyond actual occasion, there is no nothingness.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that basically actual occasions are all there are.
Okay.
And that actual occasions are space-time, and that there isn't anything beyond them. That's the universe. The universe consists of interacting actual occasions. And the actual occasions don't happen in space. They are the space in which things happen.
So then there is no nothingness.
Well, there isn't anything outside of actual occasions. Now, to say there isn't anything, is that to make a positive ontological assertion about the existence of nothingness? Probably not. I'm hoping I can say there's nothing outside of actual occasions without positing the existence of a substantial nothingness, because that would be very problematic, as you point out.
Yeah, I mean, it also comes up in various Eastern traditions, and I've just never felt comfortable.
Yeah, in the Eastern traditions, they don't talk about nothingness. They talk about emptiness.
Right, maybe I'm equating.
Which is very, very different. You know, and basically, what?
How do you see the difference?
Well, do you know the difference between apophatic and cataphatic? This is a very important distinction in religion. What?
Oh, that.
What do you mean? That's a common religious theological...
Yes, it's common. It's a common theological term. And that's why you might not know it, but of course Caleb would. But there's apophatic and cataphatic.
Is it cata or cata?
You probably cata. Yeah, thank you. So, The apophatic tradition is like the Eastern traditions, like Buddhism, which claim that the divine is so absolute that no qualities apply to it whatsoever. In other words, what's being said when they say it's empty is that it is completely beyond any application of human concepts, which doesn't mean it isn't anything. It just means that whatever it is, we can't possibly understand it. And so it's apophatic because it insists on what we can't say. Whereas the cataphatic says, yes, it's completely beyond all our human concepts, and it is ultimate being, and we can use some concepts to get an idea of what it's about, right? And so it's more theistic and more positive in its description. But the emptiness is a refusal to attribute characteristics to the vine that are going to be inadequate to its true being.
Like in Judaism?
Yeah, like it's the anti-iconoclasm in Judaism. It's like Yahweh, you can't even say the name, right? Because, right? And so it's like that. Okay. That's what they're talking about.
Omniscience, omnipotence.
But no.
That's cataphatic.
Apophatic says it's just mystery. It's just emptiness. It's sunyata. You know, it's just beyond comprehension.
Whatever is the Tao is not the Tao.
Yeah. All those, it's a huge religious impulse to point to the divine as being that about which nothing can be said, because it's beyond all that.
Yeah, do you understand my semantic difficulty with
that? Yeah, well, not such semantic, because a lot of Buddhists, crude Buddhists, will talk about it as if it's nothingness.
Right.
And the point is that when they do that, they're not making any sense.
Thanks. That's my experience. Yeah, they don't make any
No, people are more than happy to authoritatively utter poetic-sounding philosophical incoherencies all day long and expect you to believe it. And if you believe it, they'll take your money and stuff, right? So you know, we have to decide if these things make sense or not. And those particular people are expressing their own Buddhism in an incoherent form. They haven't penetrated into its meaning. Go.
How well this will work, but Hamid says that the ultimate nature of everything is absence. And if it weren't so, then there wouldn't be enough room for everything that we see.
Who says that, though?
Hamid.
The guy invented the diamond book.
The ultimate, absence. It's almost like that horrible idea about how objects withdraw from us infinitely.
I don't know. Well, I'm not expressing it right, because you know all these concepts from more of them in some way.
Yeah. Well, the point is, I think what he's saying...
Presence and absence.
What he's saying is that everything emerges out of the origin. Right?
No.
That's what he's really saying. He's picking an apophatic way to do it. So instead of saying the full potency of the divine issues in each actual occasion, he's saying each actual occasion emerges out of absence. That is, it emerges out of the absence of determinate qualities into definiteness or something.
Yeah, he doesn't push it like that, but everything is related to an experience that he has had and others he's thought have had. So,
you know, the thing is, it's pretty clear to me that the experiences that people have, really deep spiritual experiences, do not seem to have changed very much through recorded history. But the language in which they're described very clearly changes. And it's also clear there are a lot of different intellectual systems through which we can interpret these common mystical experiences. So this book I'm reading, a very interesting book, it's the Essays on the Gita by Sri Aurobindo. Now, one of the reasons it's interesting is because he's analyzing the Gita not just for what it says, and not just for why it's relevant now, but also for how it fit into its own historical context. It's fascinating, right? Because at the time the Gita was written, there were these various interpretations of yoga and God going around, right? So there was a whole Vedic school, which claimed that the only way to get to God was through ritual sacrifice. And then there was another school, the Vedantin school, which said the only way to get to salvation is to cease from all actions
go into utter quiescence, meditate, and know God. And there was another school, I forget the name, some karma yoga school, which said the only way to get enlightened is by doing good works, right? And so they had these conflicts going on, right? And so the whole point of the Gita was to reconcile these different ideas of God and these different ideas of spiritual practice, to bring them together into something workable that people can actually use in everyday life. And I was talking about some of that when I began class today, right? And so what's interesting is to see that at that particular time, I don't know exactly what the dates were, 700 AD probably, but there were these, in India, where this was a big deal, there were all these different schools advocating all these different ideas about how to get to enlightenment and what they meant. Is God inactive or is God active? Is God substantial? Is God not substantial, right? And that people were really working on this stuff, and that the ideas were important. So that the Gita represents a synthesis of ideas, which in this case becomes a great support for civilization, because it enables people to work together towards evolution, toward the evolutionary goal. And so, yeah.
I would think, given that everybody constructs their own personal world out of where they're given and what works consensually and so forth, and then cultures just differ from cultures, that all that world of constructed appearance is what you have to get through to see the ultimate truths, and so it figures that the different spiritual paths are different ways of taking the local cultural thing down through the appearances that they have, and the experiences on the path all differ from path to path.
Exactly.
They can't be directly compared, except for the end.
Right, and yet, these ideas, so Almas will describe this as an absence, and I'll describe it as a fullness, and so, you know, it's like these things, they're interesting. Right, but I find the older I get, the more I see the same truth behind all the different spiritual teachings.
So in that sense, would you consider yourself a perennialist?
Well, I'm not sure perennialism is broad enough for the truth that I'm seeing exactly. Right.
So but in a sense, you would disagree with like Jorge Ferrer's work? And
I to some extent, I do. And I do, but this is interesting. I mean, this is not something I want to be dogmatic about, because I really honor the truth of what he's saying.
Because even Almas, you know, my understanding of Almas is that he says that, like, you can't really, these are not just different languages for sort of translating the same anterior kind of experience that has a universal structure, that actually each of these paths have their own logos. And so, that's more like Ferrer's notion that, in a sense, these different paths, they're actually, in a participatory manner, like enacting worlds. And so there's like actually the divine can be experienced in this sort of pluralistic way. There's this complexity, and it's actually the fact that, you know, there are all these worlds and ways that the divine can be experienced is actually kind of points to the amazing mystery and complexity of the divine, in a sense. To me, that I find more compelling than a perennialism, and also takes more seriously kind of the insights of postmodernism.
Well, I like what you're saying, but let me ask you what you mean by perennialism, so I have a clearer sense of what that means to
you. Well, I mean, the simplistic kind of notion that I think Ferrer talks about is like the idea that there's kind of one mountain, and then you know, all these different paths are leading up the same mountain, and the top they converge, and it's basically all the different traditions are kind of different languages for experiencing the same fundamental anterior spiritual reality.
Everything you're saying rings in my ears, and I think the only difference here is an apophatic versus cataphatic, right? So that, yes, everything you're saying I completely believe. That is, God can be experienced as many, as one, as dualistic, as good or evil. I mean, you can do, you know, just all these different experiences, and many of these issue in spiritual paths that seem to be valid, and I have no argument with that. So I feel very comfortable with that. On the other hand, it seems to me that if there isn't a truth somehow at the end, then we're trapped forever. That somehow my soteriological soul, my desire for salvation, tells me that there ought to be some absolute that I can experience which will reconcile all those deep differences, right? Now, I don't know if Jorge would say that or not, but I would certainly want to say that while celebrating all the differences that Jorge celebrates, and also recognizing
that I am not a perennialist, because I would not say there's any one story to which all the others can be reduced. But I'm not exactly a deconstructionist, because I do believe there is a truth that can be experienced, and a truth that can be experienced through these different paths that is ultimately reconciling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That resonates for me personally, too.
It sounds like a collage approach, kind of like what you were saying with philosophy, too.
That's right, exactly. It's sort of a collage approach, right? It's that the number of universes that God manifests and the different things that can be true in those universes is beyond, so far beyond my imagination, I can't even imagine how far beyond my imagination it is, right? And so, the different, and God appears as everything, you know? So I'm really open to all that, and the differences are really important. I mean, for me, in a practical sense, I am very aware of each person as having an individual spiritual path. Like, that's just clear to me, and it's the foundation of my whole psychotherapeutic work, is to feel for and facilitate someone on their spiritual path.
Right. Which they can get off of and be on the wrong path?
Yeah. But sometimes, I mean, I will sometimes try to get people to shift if I think they're wrong. You know, I may succeed, I may not. I'm very gentle about that. Because they may think what they're doing is wrong, and it may lead them exactly where they need to go. And I've discovered that when people are going to go somewhere, nobody's going to stop them. I really got that, so.
I just want to follow up with that, if you don't mind. So for me, this brings up a broader question of, like, so everything you're bringing forth here, this whole metaphysical system, what's the status of it? How do you hold it, in a sense? Is this, for you, is this pointing to a universal truth? I mean, how do you account for the variability in experience across, different individuals, different cultures, different traditions?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the key problem, what I've done some work around is, like, looking at how do we move towards kind of a integral approach to a descriptive phenomenology, not just an expressive aesthetic phenomenology that's really trying to point to what are the fundamental structures that we can identify.
Right.
But, if you have any experience with that, and my experience with that is that we see a lot of variability, even if you do a lot of work to nail down the method, which is a big step. It's like, let's really get on the same page about what's the method we're using to explore a particular phenomenon. There's still a lot of variability that we see, amongst individuals that have a lot of skill and we have, like, good reason to believe this person's actually nailing this method. Why is it that our experience differs so much? Well, and that's maybe even with people in a common tradition, let alone if you start bringing in people from different cultural backgrounds, different religious traditions, spiritual paths.
Now, the differences you're talking about are about differences in descriptions of spiritual experience in general, or just any kind of phenomenological analysis?
I mean, I'm particularly interested in transphysical kind of realities and spiritual experiences, but I think it could be generalized, across the
board. Yeah, so that's a really that's a fascinating question, and I certainly couldn't give a comprehensive answer to it. I have a few comments that might be partially illuminative. And one of them is that in a world of actual occasions, you'd never expect any two occasions to see the world exactly the same way. Right? So appearance is going to be different. And so you're going to have to look, the scientific ideal of objectivity can't be realized at that level, and so you have to think about how to work with that epistemologically, and I'm not exactly sure.
And wouldn't that be true also?
The other thing I want to say, maybe before I forget, is that the experiences of the divine, according to Sri Aurobindo, are multifarious. Right. So that there are just many, many, many different experiences of the divine, all of which are valid. And so the fact that somebody's having a divine experience and is having a different divine experience doesn't mean they're experiencing a different God. They can be experiencing different aspects of the same divinity. Right? So these are just comments in relation to your question, which needs to be thought through very deeply.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to say about
that? Well, I just think that, one of the things I've been playing with throughout the semester is, like, so for me personally, at the end of the day, this needs to be sort of operationalized in some kind of, actual methodological inquiry, right?
Yes.
And so this is very interesting sort of laying the foundations for how we might engage in enterprise like that. But I think if it's really going to get off the ground, we, in a sense, need the evidence.
And I was saying to Michael earlier, I think that the key to really opening up the science of the transphysical will be the cultivation of continuity of consciousness across the river Lethe, right? Mm-hmm. It's like we have to be able to fall asleep and go into the different those other worlds and stay lucid and bring our memories back. Otherwise, we really can't get very far. It seems to me that that's sort of... But that in itself also seems to require certain conditions that are and the city life that we're living is almost antithetical to the development of the methods that would lead to the continuity of consciousness that could really open up this, right?
Yeah.
So I think we need some kind of school out in the country, right? Semi-monastic school where we can open up these worlds, because it's almost impossible under the conditions we're living in. It's just...
I totally agree.
I'll sign you up, and you find us some funders.
Take over us.
Yeah, that's what I'm really interested in, though, is that actual kind of research.
Well,
that community.
I've
sort of begun to play with this a little bit in a very initial kind of way, and you know, I think you know, there's some previous projects you know that people have engaged that I think are instructive, like early introspectionists. You know, Wilhelm Wundt. You know, mm-hmm. Basically said, I want to, you know, create a kind of introspective project that identifies the fundamental universal anatomy and physiology of human nature.
Right.
Right? And I think that was cast in a broad sense. You know, I think in a sense, this language, that would include transphysical phenomena.
Well, I think
just finish real quick?
Yeah,
you just
please.
Said basically the problem that he ran into and why that whole movement kind of died out, at least according to some interpretations, Varela's interpretations and so on, is that basically he couldn't account for, you know, what Varela calls inter-individual variability.
Right.
Why is it that they use the same method and then they have radically different experiences and there's no real way of accounting for that?
Well, it's obvious that the relevant conditions aren't being taken into account.
Well, exactly.
The same.
But that's what I'm saying, is that most... You know, phenomenology that I've seen doesn't do enough work in a sort of reflexive manner to say, like, okay, there may be different structures in individual actual occasions, have
right.
maybe different structures, different patterning, right? They might be coming from different worldviews. They might have different kind of capacities to develop in different
right.
lines. They might have
Absolutely.
Different personality types.
Of course.
And to start to map all that stuff, in a sense, it enables us to begin to kind of account for that and then we can relate this data that's otherwise, we don't know how to relate that variability. Now we can start to begin a project of relating that variability by mapping the sort of positionality of each individual actual occasion.
Yeah, see, what's interesting to me is that behind that project is the search for objectivity, right? Because the question is, well, gee, if we do the same thing and don't have the same experience, there must be something wrong. We must not be doing exactly the same thing. And so we have to figure out how to do that so we can all get the same results. Maybe that never happens. Maybe the universe is not set up so that individuals doing the same thing ever get the same results exactly. I mean, maybe,
I don't think it is.
Right. So
maybe, how do we get anywhere? And
well,
we also have the desire for to create some kind of objectivity here,
right.
to objectify the transphysical.
Right. Well, for one thing, notice that our objectification of the physical is very approximate. Right? It's like actually, for example, to objectify the world around us, we use Newtonian space-time, right? But it's wrong, but we use it anyway, right? It's sufficiently useful abstraction that we can use it, even though it isn't exactly right. The same thing will be true in the transphysical worlds. We're not looking for getting it exactly right. At this point, we're just looking for some high-level abstractions we can use to start navigating there to even start doing deeper analysis. And so it doesn't have to be exactly right, and it doesn't have to involve, you know, having exactly the same results. It can be kind of loosey-goosey at the beginning stages, right? Because we've got to just get oriented somehow, right? So, but the other thing is that there's another tool, the two tools that I want to bring up. One is that when we begin to do the kind of phenomenological analysis that you're talking about, we have to recognize, as you said, various properties of the actual occasion, including its emotional state and its aim and so forth, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so
And so in order to get phenomenological investigators who could even begin to approach consensus, they would have to be ethically aligned, they have to be, you know, in rapport by living together, they'd have to have very high motives and so forth, right? So you need very special investigators, number one. So that's really interesting, right? And number two, the Vedic peoples have outlined long lists of supernormal powers that can be cultivated. And so, for example, one of the supernormal powers is called the Anuman Siddhi, which confers the ability to see very small things as if they're big. Right? Some early theosophists did work on the structure of atoms using this siddhi and came up with results that anticipated quantum mechanical theories that were invented for 150 years later. Right? So that was some success there. There's also other siddhis that enable you to see big things as if they're very small. So you can sort of see the whole universe from outside, right? And there are siddhis that enable you to become so identified with an object that you can feel it from the inside, right? And so I think that we're not talking about just the cultivation of some method here that you can write down in a book and have rules, but we're talking about a situation in which the scientific investigation of these realities requires enormous efforts of moral purification, yogic cultivation, and the development of siddhis as opposed to the development of scientific instruments, right? Now, then if we've got a couple of really high-level practitioners who've developed the Anuman Siddhi, and they can describe the same thing they're seeing, that becomes interesting, right? But I think that we have to really take into account the yogic, the emotional, the attitudinal, and also the various cognitive powers that can be developed this way. And so to just try to go into it by using sort of a modified phenomenological method is not going to be enough, probably.
Yeah, well, I think it's the method plus all those kinds of capacities that I definitely agree
with
you.
And certainly it is interesting that the differences would have so much to do with emotional temperament and motive because those eternal objects that we conceptually prehend out of the past are those in which we're interested at a very deep level, not in which I'm interested, but in which my cells are interested. Yes.
So you said something that was really interesting to me that started this whole dialogue that I want to follow up on, something along the lines of the further along you go in your spiritual exploration, the more universals you see across them. So can you say more about that?
Well, for example, I look at Nicholas of Cusa, I look at Aurobindo, I look at Plotinus, I look at the transphysical world theories of Vedic peoples, you know. And they all kind of look the same to me. There are lots and lots of different details. But again, I won't claim that I can tell you what's common to them all because that would just be one more story. But when I look at them, they all feel to me like attempts to express the same truth using different metaphysical language and being historically situated in different ways. And somebody was asking me, I was about to talk about history for some reason. Somebody was asking me about my work and where it fits. Anyway.
So a few key words you'd be willing to give on those about universals, about this revelation of the same truth.
Well, basically, I would say, and again, this is language and you can argue with me, but I would say something like this, that there is an absolute, unconditioned, conscious reality which is everywhere and always, which transcends time and space, and of which everything else is an expression. And that the expressions of the divine are graded so that there are more, sort of more holy and less, higher grade and lower grade. And so those two things, you know, and the basic idea that the only outcome for life, the only satisfying resolution to the endless dukkha is some kind of very deep relationship with the primal ground. Right, so sort of like that, right? I could add a little more, but you get the idea, right? And everywhere I look, I just see that, and I sort of can't imagine. I think that could be wrong, but I can't imagine how else the world could be. Like, given where I am in history, this is the best I can do. It was very interesting. I'm very, very aware of how profoundly historically conditioned we all are. I mean, all of our stock of ideas comes to us from our moment. Right? Like, I could never have done my work without Orban, Doe, and Whitehead. Wouldn't have been possible. I would have had to do their work first, right, before I could do mine, but they'd already done it. Right?
That's a sequence of occasions.
What?
It's the sequence of occasions. You have to take the history and add to it. That's what we're supposed to do.
Yeah, but somebody asked me, who was it, about whether I considered this absolute or where I saw it, and I got...
That was me.
It was you. Okay. So I didn't finish answering that. I want to say that that I don't consider what I'm writing to be anything approaching anything like any kind of final truth. I consider what I'm doing to be this. I am carrying on, first of all, a very, very long tradition of people who are trying to express something about the relationship between God and life. And that goes way back. And that in particular, I am operating at the beginning of the integral era and the end of the mental era. And so I am trying to use Whitehead and Aurobindo to give expression to this deeper truth that I feel in language that's appropriate to the present moment. Right? And so I am trying to articulate ideas which can serve as the foundation for a reworking of both science and spirituality in a way that demonstrates them as being the same project and concerning the same topics. And that by this whole notion of actual occasions and everything I've been talking to you about, it breaks us out of all the sterile conundrums of modernity and puts us in a place to take a new, fresh shot at the whole thing. That's what I'm trying to do. Right? And, you know, I the only other group that I've really been presenting these ideas to has been the people at ESLA. Right? And that has been one of the most depressing and discouraging experiences of my entire life. Because having presented to them for about 6 years running, they just simply refused to get what I'm talking about. And I finally realized that they are so locked into classical thinking that they can't even begin to understand Aurobindo and Whitehead. And therefore, to understand me is just out of the ballpark, right? They just simply can't do it. That's one of the reasons this class has been such a pleasant shock to me. You know, like I hear you guys using the language and using it to help make sense of your experience. You're actually experimenting with it. You're open to it, right? God, what a thrill that is for me after having dealt with those bosons for 5 years.
Yeah. So what do you think about the fact that, because if you have classical science and classical scientists doing what they're doing, and then you have us over here, and then you have these people in the middle, which I guess are the Esalen people, but these people who are really progressive, really edgy thinkers, who are the hope for whatever they call the human project that they're working on there or whatever.
I don't know.
So, okay, if those are our leaders into the future, they're really not.
They're not.
If they're not able to grok what it is that you are, what this is trying to explicate, the bridge that this is trying to build between the old and the new.
That's what I think.
And what do you see as the movement towards the integral consciousness, any kind of meaningful, large-scale way?
Nothing. Well, not true. I see a lot of unconscious manifestations of it all over the place. Mm. And the whole second part of Gebser's book, Ever-Present Origin, is a description of all these ways in which the integral was showing up. The integral was taking over, but it hasn't reached any kind of central self-recognition of itself.
Because we're still in the mental deficient, even as the integral efficient is rising.
That's right.
Unconscious, the integral is unconscious.
Well, in a sense, for example, as I said earlier, Gebser would claim that Marxism is an inception of the integral. Now, Marxists don't think about it that way, and they don't have to, but that's, you know, Gebser's observing that. Gebser would say that Picasso is an inception of the integral. Well, why? Picasso wasn't thinking about being integral. He was just thinking about being Picasso, right? Mm-hmm. Quantum physics is an inception of the integral, not because they were trying to do it, but because it's happening. Right? So the integral is happening. But I haven't seen I mean, CIS is the closest thing to an institution that's dedicated to it, and our dedication is very weak and very fuzzy.
Right? That's true. That's true.
Yeah. No, I mean, I went to a conference, not a conference, a little afternoon meeting on the topic of what is integral. He'd give it here at CIS. And Monty Montori was on the panel, and I forget who, Jim Ryan. And it was an absolute embarrassment. I mean, to begin with, they hadn't prepared. I was insulted that they would cross me across town and not prepare for their lectures, number one. But more importantly, they were saying really fuzzy, meaningless things about the integral. And so finally, I raised my hand and I said, the word integral comes to CIS from Fiorbindo. And he had a perfectly clear definition of it. And so why don't we try using that? Right? I said, I was worse than that. I said, look, you guys, what we need is a good meta-narrative. I shouldn't have said that, right? So, and then I said, Sri Aurobindo's got this definition, why don't we just use his, right? And boy, did they come down on me like a ton of bricks, right? Oh, no, because then we might agree. That would be terrible. We wouldn't want to agree with each other. I mean, what? You can't build civilization on disagreement, right? So.
And Wilbur has a clear definition of integral, by the way, which doesn't get enough airtime.
Well, what does he say?
Well,
the four quadrant thing.
It's a longer conversation. I don't have a pithy little thing to shoot off to you.
Okay,
right here.
Because I've been very unimpressed with his definition so far.
I have a question about Esalen.
Yeah,
I'm kind of shocked by the impressions you just gave us because this was written for them.
I none of them read it though. I also did a series of five lectures for them on video. None, they didn't watch it either.
It seems like you do share one of their major concerns, which is the continuation of the personality beyond.
Yeah. I share all their concerns.
Just not how.
But basically, it's this: they are conventional scientists who are brave enough to face up to the overwhelming experimental evidence for parapsychological phenomena, and take it seriously.
But isn't that I just lost it. Oh man, isn't that concern a feature of the classical science?
No, classical science in general will argue that parapsychological evidence is all false or should be considered false even if it's true because it's too disruptive to be thought about. I mean, the classical science, if you want to read something interesting about this, there's a great book called The Trickster and the Paranormal by a guy named Hansen, who's a magician, today's magician. A fascinating book. And he talks about how the academic world is set up to defend itself against parapsychology because it's too disruptive. And so these are guys who get it. I mean, they've all seen parapsychological stuff happen. They believe it. They know it's real. But they're committed to trying to explain it in ways that won't offend anybody. So they want to try to explain it scientifically, which is, of course, in terms of the old science, which is completely impossible. And they're simply unwilling to face up to the ontological and paradigmatic implications of their data. They just won't stretch their imaginations wide enough to imagine a universe in which what they're studying is actually possible.
That's what I meant before when we were talking on the break, and I was saying this is such a departure from logic.
Well, I don't consider that. I happen to love logic, and I consider myself to be eminently logical.
But yeah, you are, but you use imagination and intuition, and all of that is part of your logic.
Yeah.
And this is a good description of how logic is itself really limiting.
It's not logic that's limited, it's their thinking that's limited.
Or
logic
the types of logic that they're balancing.
The type of logic that they're using.
Which is analogous to what we were talking about before the break. The things that constrain the physical world are much more exact and much more constraining.
That's right.
And they're bound by the physical world. And if you try to explain things within the context of the physical world, this cannot be explained.
Right. That's right.
And yet most people, when you go beyond that kind of conversation, it gets woo-woo, and you're not sure what they mean, and they're talking about energy.
Because they go mythic. They go mythic.
And
as soon as they start to talk about the transphysical, they collapse into a mythic consciousness. What I'm trying to do is bring a mental consciousness to the study of the transphysical.
Yeah.
I don't know anybody else who's doing that this way.
So when you say they go mythic, when they think about the transphysical, that means that they can't think about it logically? They think
it
about
means that it... They don't think about it in terms of time or space or causality.
Or they think about it as some mythical reality.
But yeah, okay. Or just dreamlike. They think of the whole thing as being like dreamlike. Right. They don't try to sort out spatial, temporal, or causal relations obtaining in the other world.
It seems like as soon as you say that it's actual, like as soon as we say a dream world is also an actual world, that shifts things. Like I'm trying to think, what are the keys that are locking them into the position they're in? It's probably just a couple small things that if those things shift or unlock, they're going to say, oh, okay.
Well, one of them is what I said earlier, is this inner-outer distinction, making the distinction between mind and matter, a spatial distinction. That's one of the crucial blocks to the imagination there. Thinking of space as an extended, substantial nothingness, huge obstacle. Thinking of mathematical forms, the only forms that count, huge obstacle. Things like that, right? There aren't that many... Although people have different lists, I'm sure. But.
So, I wanted to make this point earlier. In terms of who the leaders are, if you want to paraphrase Christopher Wren, if you want to see who the leaders are of the integral, look around you.
Oh, no.
Okay? I mean, James and Abinett, I mean, you know, Libby Ball, whoever, people who've been through this program, okay?
Yeah.
Look around you if you want to see who the leaders of the integral are. And we have to step into that if we want to take that responsibility. Because there's not many people other than us who have that kind of grasp at this point.
I think one of the unfortunate things about Esalen, too, is that it's trying to use the classical to connect to the new world emerging paradigm. Because you can't really... I mean, in the way that you're doing it, you can do it. But in the way that they want to do it... It can't be done.
No, I know that. I know that, and so I'm just sort of hoping that if they try and fail long enough, they might eventually turn to me, right? But politics, right? It's really weird.
You get a paycheck based on doing what you did, not on taking risks, and
that's right.
There's no security, and
that's right.
And you can be ridiculed, and
that's right. I mean, you know, you guys might be aware that taking a position like mine, which is so radically different, is very stressful and very lonely and hard, right? So most people don't want to do it, right? And most of the people at Esalen are professional academics, which I am not really, right? I have a couple of adjunct teaching jobs that makes me 12,000 a year or something. I'm not really a professional academic. And they are, and their jobs depend on it. And the level of blindness and ignorance and dogma and prejudice that are in all the universities in America will just knock your socks off. But they just cannot say these things without getting fired.
That's the personality, the personal sequence of actual occasions in those institutions, that they have to come from a past, a causal past, into the present. And so... To shift that, to shift a whole new personality, those shifts are not, they're not usually radical, and if they are, they're actually dangerous.
Extremely.
And it's extreme. Best to be gentle and allow things to emerge in culture.
Yeah, it'd be nice, except that the old way of doing things is destroying the planet, so there's a certain kind of urgency, but it doesn't really matter.
Paradigms shift one feeder
at
a time.
What I'm hearing in this conversation about relating to other people is actually what's striking me more. Is it appears there's a context, we're like placing this context on people. And I think to an extent it's true.
But doing what on people?
We're like creating a context of who they are and these generalities. And that's, I'm feeling really frustrated because I worked in PR for 7 years and I was able to not convince people, because anytime you convince someone of something, it doesn't work. But I would show people through very simple ways of believing something they didn't believe before. And so I think that there's a way, I mean, I got paid to basically spin things in a way that people would think that they believed things they didn't think they actually believed. And so I'm really struck by this way that when we talk about relating to people, if we put them so much in this way of they're like this, and they're like this, and they're like this, there's no way real communication can even happen. And so I'm feeling all this anxiety of like, well, but if we're thinking of them that way, then of course they're not going to believe anything we say, because we're coming from this place of who we think they are. And so I think to an extent sometimes, yes, people are this way and they do think this way, but there's a way of relating to them where they aren't that way. And I think that feels like what's missing sometimes.
You'll come with me to Esalen next time and coach me.
Well, one beautiful thing in a Montessori classroom, the teachers are trained that every day when the child walks in, they look upon the child as a new child.
Right.
Today might be the day they don't scream and cry when they walk in the door. And it's very challenging, you know, with a husband who's stuck in the scientific paradigm and the discussions we have over the years, I try to look at him every time as, today's the day when he's going to say, oh, something just slipped, something changed. And it happens little by little.
It's that danger of thinking you know someone.
Yeah.
And I feel like that we're speaking to this major danger that happens across the entire planet of thinking that we know who someone is. I think it becomes even more dangerous when we use that way about strangers or people we don't know as well.
You know, I obviously have to agree with you, but there is something useful about the generalities also.
I agree.
And so we have to be very careful.
Yeah, there's a fine line between generalities and also the last time, new creation.
It was a little personal, but the last time I was at Esalen, I probably told you guys this. I had a 2.5-hour slot, and I spent the whole time fighting with everybody. Mm-hmm. It was grueling, and at the end, the conclusion I got was, you know, we don't know whether you're right or not, and it would take us a lot of work to find out, so we're not going to bother.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's a little hard to go back, right? But, of course, that's also my sensitivity. There were people who liked what I was saying, and I'm ignoring them right now. So it'll be interesting to see what happens this year. But I'm going to remember what you said. This may be the year things change. It's going to be a totally new conference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really appreciate that point. And something that really stood out to me when I was studying social psychology in my master's program was on the topic of effective persuasion, when you're up against a seeming extreme, you know, institutionally. And according to the research, it does tend to turn into mutual alienation and gridlock, even if one extreme is right. and in the best interest of this planetary emergency that we're in, but the most influential way to affect change is through a more moderate approach, because people get freaked out.
Yeah.
And, you know, people are attached to their ideas. Everybody's, I think a lot of this physically obsessed approach to everything, you know, in the Western world is fear-based. Gives us a false sense of control.
Yes.
So yeah, I think I appreciate your point that there is this urgency, and I appreciate your outspokenness, but at the same time, just for whatever it's worth, social psychology, which is devoted to like how we affect each other interpersonally, is stating like it does tend generally to backfire.
Yeah.
Actually, I would disagree.
Actually, I don't want to spend a lot more time on this because it's really off the subject of our class. I just want to say one last thing, which is not about any of this. I just want to say that a lot of really great work is being done at Esalen. And my personal difficulties with this one group at Esalen should not reflect badly on the institution, particularly on the institution of Esalen Center for Theory and Research, which does a lot of incredibly great work. And this conference is doing really important work. I'm just personally frustrated, but this should not be interpreted as a criticism of what's being done there. Please, it's important to me that they do great work, okay?
Can I make one last comment on that?
Yeah.
I mean, to me, it's potentially an invitation also to say, like, you know, if what you're trying to go for with this is, like, to communicate this to actually have a transformational impact in the culture of science and so on, it might be some kind of invitation to say, how can I communicate this in a way, in another way, that progressive scientists can get and resonate with, rather than, oh, they're just glocked in a
mind. I think about that all the time. I've just kind of been failing. That's all.
Yeah.
Not that I haven't been asking.
But I think
question.
It's a great question for all of us, because I think we're all interested in that in some form.
Well, in that sense, it's right on topic, because if we go to the empathic networks and the telepathic networks that exist, we just need to get more in touch with them, then our method of communication will be much easier.
That's right. That's important.
Work on that.
That's huge.
That is so huge, you know, like that's why, for example, I would like to see these groups at Esalen be much more ritually oriented, right? So we could actually create rapport and begin to bring ourselves together. But they're terrified of anything like that, most of those guys. They're just horrified at the thought, you know. So we occasionally will, some of the young guys, like me, will occasionally sneak in some ceremony or something, and the old guys just, really, I'm not a young guy anymore, but for that purpose I am, right? And so right, and so it's just I think you're aptly right. So let's see if we can get back to a few more of these points before we end. We saw that the time-space relation is a restriction on what is possible. For example, the four-dimensional continuum of relativity theory tells us where and when occasions belonging to the physical world can happen. If they take place outside that continuum, they are not, by definition, part of that world. Eternal objects are, in their nature, possibilities, and logic is a study of the systematic relations among eternal objects. We can treat the time-space relation as a logical structure and explore it using the methods of logic and mathematics. This is really important, right? Because now we can say why logic and mathematics are important here. Right? Okay. We saw that logical systems may be more or less constrained by definitions and axioms. The greater the number of definitions and axioms, the more restricted are the possibilities that that structure explores. The less constrained the time-space relation is, the freer it is, and the further it is from the narrowness of physical existence. Metageometry, which explores time-space relations that are less constrained than the metrical time-space governing inorganic occasion, maps the geometrical structures of the transphysical worlds. Now, this is an original idea. This is probably my most original idea, is to suggest that the domains opened up by metageometry, by the non-Euclidean geometries, by projective geometry, by topology, and by network topology, that these are mathematical descriptions of transphysical worlds. Nobody else thought of that. It's kind of fun. Let's see if it works. But I like it.
So
okay.
Whitehead did not do geometries like this?
He didn't do variable geometries. He was just concerned with deriving, basically he was concerned with deriving the metrical space-time continuum from topology. That was basically what he was interested in.
That's great work, man. That's really interesting what you did.
Yeah. We clarified why classical measurement is possible only in a metrical time space. Classical measurement being measurement that involves rulers and clocks. And a metrical time space in which parallel postulates are specified. The time space relation of the inorganic occasions of our cosmic epoch is metrical, which is why physics works so well in the physical world. We saw that projective geometry does not stipulate a parallel postulate, but that it does define points and lines. This is a time space relation of perception, both in the waking world and in those parts of the transphysical worlds that most resemble the physical. We saw, too, that extensive geometry defines a particular set of relations among regions without defining points and lines. It is still more general than projective geometry. And we saw that non-extensive networks trace networks of relations among occasions that are not smooth and continuous in the way that extensive relations are. Non-metrical geometry functions between occasions and... That's wrong. It should be non-extensive networks instead of non-metrical geometry. Everybody have panic tomorrow? I got to change that. Thank you. Non-extensive networks function between occasions and memory, and in many dreams that are too strange to remember clearly upon awakening. Interactions among occasions in most transphysical worlds define network geometries. What I'm pointing out here is that the smoothness of space can be logically defined, and it's a particular property, right? It says, for example, if there's a given region, it'll be contained in another region, and it will contain subregions, and if A contains B, and B contains C, A contains C, all these different kinds of relations that establish the continuum of space-time. But that there can be networks that are not continuous that way, as, for example, in the network topologies of computers, in which there's a lot of interconnection, but it's not smooth in the same way that it is in space-time, in waking space-time. For Further, we saw that the human personality, considered as a personally ordered society of high-grade actualities, inhabits a complex network time-space. Modern electronic technology can help us to visualize such a network. Imagine that our consciousnesses were embodied in a machine with the capacity to send and receive multiple streams of electromagnetic energy. For example, communicating via radio signals the way cell phones do. We could then be in contact with various other entities, none of whom would necessarily be in contact with each other. See, this is really important, because I think in dreams, I could be talking to you, and I could be talking to you, but you guys wouldn't be talking to each other. In other words, I could be next to you, and next to you, but you two wouldn't have to be next to each other in the dream space. You see, it's a network topology instead of a continuum topology. Okay, a world such as this would be very different from our world, but there's no metaphysical reason why such a world is impossible. It is in the context of non-metrical geometries at certain occasions in our past. Again, that should be non-extensive networks, it should be. That certain occasions in our past need to be felt or positively apprehended in the present. Please have a hand. Thank you. We know that the space-time of visual experience is extensive and projective, and the time-space of physics is a framework for coordinating various perspectives into a shared world that has an extensive metrical geometrical continuum. But this is not the time-space of experience as a whole. Waking experience comprehends the various time-space relations characterizing the various senses, as well as networks, the network time-space of memory, imagination, and dream. So those are the basic parts of the chapter. We've now gone through them. And I have a feeling you understand them fairly well. Any questions or comments or evaluations of these ideas? I'm kind of interested in evaluations, you know, like, you're the first sympathetic audience I've ever had. What do you think?
Really? Group hug.
Are these interesting ideas? Are they helpful, you know? Do they seem to illuminate reality? Yeah.
Well, I especially love the geometry stuff, because it's a way to apply mathematics and more precisely define and regularize notions of structure, even very freeform stuff, structure. Math turns into poetry at a certain point in terms of the subtlety that it can be.
Right.
And the group theory idea is very cool. But this would just be me.
I find it difficult to, there's certain things about like technical language, specifically mathematical language, is you're taking common sense experience. In order to describe that in this mathematical language takes a lot of words.
Yeah.
And it's like very particular, and so what happens is it becomes like so complex for something that seems very simple. It seems very simple, this Newtonian physics that's going on in a common sense way, but in order to describe what it is and what it is not, it takes so much language.
That's right, it does.
I tend to skip steps anyway, and so it's like very grueling discipline
it is.
Work to go line by line by line.
And that's what it requires.
Cover every possible question, not the question I have now, but if you were to come up with a different question, it's already been answered, you know? So getting answers to questions I don't even have yet, and that takes more discipline to like see the meaning in those aspects.
I appreciate that. Yeah.
It's just a personal...
Yeah. Well, you know, my own experience is that I'll read a book like this, and if it interests me, then I'll go and read the people who the author read first, and then I'll come back to the book, right? So I'll go to the footnotes and figure out who the major sources were, then I'll read the major sources, then I'll be able to understand the book, right? So I do a lot of that. So, you know, if you study Whitehead and Aurobindo, it'll help you a lot understanding Weiss.
And I also like, I'm really a visual learner, so when it comes to like mathematics, like to talk about geometry is a lot more difficult than to see it.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry about that.
No, I mean, just saying, I'm just giving you, it's all the feedback I can think of right now.
Yeah.
But actually that, to me, opens up ways to expand the chapter having diagrams or like the explanation of like Caleb's over here and Linda's over here or whatever.
Rosie, I'm really hoping that you guys are going to do that.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
So I'm just thinking about this right now because when there's a shift and everyone starts seeing things this way, not everyone's going to study this to see it that way. They're
That's
just suddenly going to see it.
That's
so,
right.
You know, some of us who like this kind of thing, who can actually digest it, seems like we need to then translate it into other ways for other people to understand. And is that what the whole idea is? Like, people are going to do poetry on this, they're going to do art on this.
Absolutely.
And then for somehow that's going to get through to people in a different way. And suddenly, because I like this stuff, so I digest it and I feel like I get it, but then I forget it because I don't need it anymore because I'm there. So I feel like I've seen it and now it's here. And if you can get that through a piece of art or by listening to music, you know, that's a lot easier for a lot of different people. So I'm just
I believe that the things that I'm writing about, the perceptual shifts I'm suggesting, are inevitable. And I don't think that we're going to cause, you know, like Gebser talks about, maybe we're traveling through a different region of the galaxy or something. I am noticing the eruption of the integral. I see it everywhere I look now. And I have this idea that this is happening willy-nilly, but human beings get the privilege of giving it formal expression. Right? And the way it's formally expressed makes a big difference. Right? If it's formally expressed well, it builds a better civilization. Right? And so what I'm trying to do is to articulate the principles of the mutation of consciousness that I feel is emerging in the hope of crystallizing it to make it more real, to ground it more. Right? And the privilege is to get to form the ideas, right? To put together propositions that seem to reflect this emerging reality in a way that helps us to experience it more deeply, to communicate more effectively about it, and to bring this civilization into being more quickly and more beautifully through this kind of language.
It's like you're drafting the blueprint
of
it.
So well, it's like the blueprints being drafted, regardless of whether we do it or not. You know, it's happening.
The thing is coming into being one way or another. I'm trying to draw a blueprint in the middle of the whole thing.
Well, where would the mental expression of the integral happen? It would happen in academia. It would happen in
places like here. Right.
But the more like mythic is happening in other places and magical, and so in people who are performing art and music people in theater.
That's right.
It's emerging there. It just looks very different.
That's right. I'm just trying to do the metaphysical crystallization of a much bigger process that's happening all around us.
It's like a species of thought.
Yeah, it's a species
of thought.
Like
when there's a certain energetic, different species emerge, or when you're at a different evolutionary point, a species will emerge as a representation.
Exactly.
It's like it's there, and then you articulate, and it becomes this.
That's right. And I feel it's a really deep groundwork for the articulation of integral metaphysics was done by Whitehead and Aurobindo. I am synthesizing their work and carrying it on to the next generation. Okay, everybody, this has been a really nice class. Can't wait to see you next week. Have a wonderful week. Thank you.